time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy, Alex, and Jason are all here. We'll have Jason's review of the iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max. We'll talk about the camera, a new review from Sebastian DeWitt of Halide, what iOS 17.1 is going to do to the action button, and why Tim Cook just cashed in a whole bunch of stock. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 890, recorded Tuesday, October 10th, 2023. 100 chickens. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Mylio. Mylio Photos is a smart and powerful system that lets you easily organize, edit, and manage years of important documents, photos, and videos in an offline library hosted on any device. And it's free. Don't wait. Visit mylio.com/twit. And by ZocDoc, the free app where you can find and book appointments online with thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed physicians and specialists. Filter specifically for the ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat almost any condition. Go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak and download the ZocDoc app for free. And by ZipRecruiter. Good news, if you're hiring, you've got help. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter works for you to find great candidates fast. Its smart technology identifies qualified candidates for you, and you can invite your top choices to apply. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest from Apple, of which there is nothing. But we will manufacture something, as Andy Inoko full well knows. Hello, Andrew.
Yeah, the suffix to the phrase "we have no news today" is that okay? Everyone, get ready for a 3-hour long show because we're just going to chat and have fun.
Yeah, that's what happens.
We don't need to rush to get to the next story. I can tell you about this weird squirrel I saw the other day with half a tail.
Next, comic book chat. Jason Snell, sixcolors.com. He has something to talk about his iPhone 15 review.
Yeah, some very late reviews happened. That's really great. Leo, there's always something to talk about in the Apple world. Always. And if not, then we will make it something to talk about.
We will make things up. And from officehours.global, Alex Lindsay. Hello, Alex.
Good morning.
It's good to see you. Next week, I will be doing the show from Mom's Basement. I have ordered a green screen so I could take a picture of Mom's Basement and not actually be in her basement, which will be nice. Okay. Going out to Rhode Island next week for a week to visit Mom, and I'll be doing that probably a little more. I'm going to set up. It was $30 on Amazon. It's not a good green screen. I'll show you, just so you know. But I want to set up a little kind of permanent. It's a Jabutu. When the Jabutu goes on, the name goes on. I just figured this would probably work for me. Just it has a stand. It has C clamps and it's green. high green. Quality polyester fiber material. Not prone to wrinkles.
I have one if you want to test it.
I have one too, but I don't want to carry it to Rhode Island. I have a very nice one from Elgato that's they have in schools where you open it up.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not going to carry a 80-pound green screen to Rhode Island. So I'm shipping this to Mom's. And I'll set it up, and I'm going to leave it there along with a bunch of other stuff so that I don't have to.
Yeah, that's my method.
Yeah.
That's the Amazon. Just I tell my mom, look, there's an office chair.
There's some boxes coming. Yeah.
Bring it in, and I'll unpack it.
Yeah. Yep. That was always my dream of when I go back and forth to Africa to our school, my dream was always to travel with a backpack. Like, just I got all my stuff in another place, and I got to do it once, and it was the most amazing thing ever. Like, I don't need any.
Yeah,
like, I have my clothes and everything is all on the other side, because I had a room there and I had a little, like, my dresser there in for a while, and so I could just travel. And I think I only did it actually once because I was always coming from somewhere else. It was like, this is the life, is just to be able to go to a and just travel all over the world in a backpack.
Do you think I should add this to my kit? Because I think it might be handy if I want to disappear.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. That is that I wouldn't even say that that's a kind of should have. That is,
it's
a
only $12.
$11?
It's a green, absolutely, for those who are listening, green gloves and a green hood. And then I could be the Invisible Man. It'd be.
I think you'll use the hood more than the gloves, but I think you should get both.
Wouldn't that be funny? All right, I'll send that to Mom too. Bye now.
Well, that's great because they'll solve so much trouble because when you're traveling, like, what if, like, Mike or somebody is guest hosting? That way you can still travel and do the show, but they can superimpose
his
the guest host's head upon
on
yours.
Me. Oh, good thinking. So
we'll maintain the status quo. You see, once you have a procedure, once you have, like, a protocol set, you know, it's more expensive to, like, revise the protocol than to simply make it work.
Yeah. This will also make a good Halloween costume if I don't want to be seen.
Yeah, it's every Halloween costume. That's beautiful.
Yeah. I do have a serious question. I would very much like a, a 14-inch mini LED M3 MacBook Pro. Any shot that that's going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks?
Ooh, MacBook Pro, no. No shot.
No shot, yeah.
No, because the M3 will come out first. Is the pattern.
Oh, you think the 13-inch will be, you think it'll be the 13-inch first?
Well, I mean, I think the 13-inch MacBook Pro is always a question mark because nobody understands why that product exists other than on a price list.
I don't want to buy it, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the pattern thus far with two iterations in the Apple Silicon era is you start with the M series, you know, the M1, M2, M3, and then the Pro and Max and Ultra, if it exists, variations come several months later. So I think if we get any M3 Max this year at all, they'll just be bare M3. And they would be, yeah, sometime in the next month or so. But it's going to be like an iMac or a Mac Mini or a MacBook Air, maybe. But I don't think there'll be pros until maybe mid-next year, spring, but maybe even later than that. Keep in mind, too, they're coming from the TSMC 3-nanometer is what everybody expects. It'll be on the new process that the iPhone chips are on. And if that's the case, like, that's a new line, and it's just getting up to speed, and I think it's making as many iPhone chips as it can, and maybe it's making as many M3s as it can. But to get to that next level where it's using a Pro or a Max feels like that's going to be down the road a little bit. So I think you've got no chance of, Leo, no chance of a new MacBook Pro this fall.
Because everybody seemed to agree there would be no event. And I think at this point, here we are October 10th, there's no way there's going to be an event. So maybe there'd be a slipped out press release of some kind. Do you think there'll be an iPad, or what do you think that if there is a press release? And by the way, if they don't do it in the next 2 weeks, it's over till next year, right?
I mean, well, they've done things in November before.
Really?
But yeah, I think the sooner the better. Yeah, they would prefer not to, but it sometimes happens that stuff is stacked up and they do things.
Is there an issue? You think the yields on the 3-nanometer process, and that's part of the reason? Who knows? We don't know. No one.
It's a new process. I wouldn't bet against it.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons things become cheaper later is because all those issues are gone. But we eat a lot of those in the cost. When people say, oh, well, this is how much it costs, what they're not taking into account, when they do a tear down and say, this is what this item costs at retail or whatever, or this is what all these parts cost, they don't take into account how many they're sending back. I think that the numbers were something like they were sending 40% of the touchpads back when they first did it. You know, so it's there's a lot of loss as they get off the ground, and then it starts to normalize, and then we pay less for the, you know, for the lower quality or the older ones because of that.
So I still don't know what the guidance is. Will there be a press release this month, and what would it be?
Oh, well, I think M3 Mac is a possibility, but it's like probably not going to be super exciting like an iMac. The iMac hasn't been updated since M1. MacBook Air got an update fairly recently. So
yeah, that's
if I
this
had
year.
To guess, I'd guess that would be early next year.
And
instead,
the 14 and 16-inch were this year as well, right? They were in January.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no reason to update those yet.
Yeah. So like iMac, maybe M3 for the Christmas season. And then there are talks about iPads. But again, it might just be update the iPad mini, update, you know, the iPad Air or something like that. Not the iPad Pros, because those are also sort of not rumored until next year.
And I think that last year, I can't remember if it was the end of last year, the beginning of this year, they did a release where there was no you know, fanfare, but there was a video. So yeah. they released not just a press release, but they released a whole video that mm-hmm. promoted sure. it that was 15 minutes long or whatever, and then they moved on, and it was effective.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It just wasn't tune in live at 10 a.m. in order right. to see it, right?
They just posted it.
They had a, you know, they did a drop of, it's no longer just a press release drop, right? It can be a video drop at the same time, which is what they like to do.
And it really could be something. I think that they're trying. I think that they won't, unless they're doing a press event, they probably won't do a live activation, although they could. You know, they could easily just push out a live stream that has no stage without press or anything else. But I think that they don't want to do that because I think that it would have people not know what they're going to get. They can't announce, we're doing a live event, and then they just play out a live video and then move on. I don't think they were able to do that during COVID. I don't think they'd get away with it now. You end up with less people showing up for the actual live event. So I think there's probably delineation there where it says we're just going to release videos for things that we don't have a full press, quote unquote. I think they want to keep that rare, is my guess. Because there is a power for them to go, even if it's only all pre-recorded, there's a power to going live so that everyone talks about it at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes more of an event than just posting it. But they seem to get a couple views no matter what.
Okay. I'm not waiting.
17th, by the way. 11/17 will be the last.
That's the last chance.
Last chance we would see.
1 week from today.
I don't think they've ever done anything in December. Yeah. They've done stuff in November, but I don't think they do anything in December.
Usually. 11/17. Oh, okay.
Yeah, 11/17, I think, is the last day.
The other question is, like, what do they have to gain by launching something in October or November this year? It's mostly the reason would be that they already have a lot of their lineup or their targets set for 2024, and they don't want to collide with it. Like if they're just doing a tune up of the iMac, why would you want to have that affect the release of the or take some of the drama away from the release of the Vision Pro, and may as well just I want to say you want to dump it in October, November, but this is the sort of thing where you can just sort of slide it under the mat and, you know, hey, for those of you who care about a brand about an M3 powered Mac Mini, here it is.
Well, yeah, sometimes it comes down to quarterly result management. You know, like if mm-hmm. they're doing really well at the beginning, at the first half of the quarter, and they go, oh, I think we're going to do fine going through it, then they may push it off because they can use it somewhere else. Whereas if they feel like they'd like to push, make sure that this quarter does particularly well, Jason's probably more of an expert at that. I know other companies do that. They definitely decide on release dates based on how they're doing in the first half of the quarter. They have something they have done and they could announce it at the middle of one quarter or the beginning of the next quarter. And that date has to do with how well they think they're doing financially. And because you don't want to use up more powder than you need to for the report.
Yeah, holiday quarter is there are a lot of iPhone sales, so that swamps everything else. But if they have, like, I really think of it as, is there a product out there that we think we like to sell at the holidays that's a little too old? I think that's question one. And the iMac absolutely qualifies because it did not get an M2 iteration at all.
And the iPad Mini, right?
That would be the iPad Mini is
perfect
another one.
Yeah, stocking exactly. stuffer.
Stocking yes. stuffer. So I think you look at those and you're like, okay, that might be a reason to do it. And then with the M3, I also wonder if, like, the Apple's most popular computer is the MacBook Air. So M3, if we're talking about a new production line and a new chip and it's all a new process and all of it is new, maybe you start with a computer that is not your big seller because you know you're just not going to be able to enough of MacBook Air chips. But maybe an iMac, we can do that volume now because they're trying to build up to the point where they can sell as many MacBook Airs as they can.
I bet there's a pent-up demand for iMacs, though, for that, you know, higher-end iMacs.
I think, just in general, it's a desktop, right? So it's not going to be the best seller. And they have four different desktops now, which is more than they've had in a while. So it's a little bit less of that. But the fact is, there is a solid iMac market out there, and they haven't serviced it since that original M1 iMac. So there's something there. It's not something to get super excited about, but there's something.
iMac used to be the best seller, but I guess that was back in the desktop era, right? And it's now definitely.
Yeah, I mean, three quarters of the Macs they sell are laptops. At this point, right? Like it's somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters. Last, they don't report it anymore, but it was headed that direction the last time they reported volumes. It was three-quarters of sales, and now you've got the iMac and the Mini and the studio and the pro. And so there's a lot. So it's a slice of that. When the next to last or last Intel models came out, I actually talked to the product marketing manager for the iMac for a while at their launch event. And, you know, she made it clear that, like, there is a real iMac market. And because the Mac,
who's going to put
the iPhone,
computers
the
in all the Hyatt business centers? You got
to. Well, that's what they, honestly, that's that. It's funny. That is what it's like, hotel lobbies and public places. And there are still families that want to have a shared computer space because they've got like little kids and they don't want to have a bunch of laptops around for everybody, but they'll buy one computer for the house. Like, it is another company would consider it a major market, right? Like, it's a lot of money. It's just in the grand scheme of Apple, it's not, but this might be an opportunity for them to, again, it's just been languishing. It got that big update with the M1 with the colors and all that. And then since then, nothing. So it's a good time. They should do it. I say.
I agree. Now, please.
Take that.
I would love to see a new Mini.
Do it.
Yeah.
Sure.
There is a problem, though, that the old Mini is perfectly fine. There's not
the problem with the Mini. The problem with the Mini is that the Mini now comes in a Pro M2 Pro configuration.
Yeah.
So the Mini probably wouldn't get updated until they've got an M3 Pro chip so that they can put out both configurations because they don't do those separately.
Yeah.
So that's not I feel like what Macs only use the base model. And it's like, okay, it's the Air and the iMac, right? I think that's it, that only let you use the base model and that 13-inch Pro. So those are the buddies. So some, you know, are all the buddies going to go or probably not? Maybe it's just the iMac. Maybe it's that MacBook Pro 2 that nobody cares about. I don't know.
You know, Google kind of little shot across the bow last week with their Pixel announcement. They said 7 years of security updates and OS updates. We're gonna support this phone for 7 years. Now, Apple doesn't say how long they're going to support stuff, but they just cut with iOS 17 cut off the iPhone 8 and the 10S, I think.
No, the 10.
10?
10S is still covered.
10S is still covered. So that's 5 years. Uh-huh. Is Apple challenged? Has Google thrown down the gauntlet?
No, Google has fixed one of the biggest holes in the leaking robot.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is a couple of years ago, they said, "Oh, very big deal. We have a really big deal. We're going to make sure that your phone will be up, will be supported for 2 years or 3 years for security updates." Meanwhile, Samsung was saying, "Yeah, we can outdo that by 1 or 2 years," and that's always been like one of the biggest like fundamental problems with the Pixels as a platform, and actually with Android as a platform, not knowing how long you're going to get these updates for. And I don't see it as a big challenge. I don't see it as a challenge because Apple, I mean, they have an established track record on this. I mean, they didn't have to make an announcement of here's how long we're going to support every single thing. They basically made a covenant with all of its customers saying that we will support this hardware as long until the moment that Jesus calls your phone home, we will try to supply you with new updates for everything. Whereas, I mean, I thought that this announcement was one of the most important and nicest things that was announced last week. That, well, okay, great. So not only do they realize that there's a problem, but either because of the way they designed the hardware, now the way they've spent like 5 years redesigning how they can deploy and build and push out new updates for Android in general. They were able to make this promise, but so much was, oh, well, it doesn't really mean anything. Remember all the times that Google has canceled messaging platforms. I'm like, okay, but they've said explicitly that if you buy this phone, we will give you this thing. That's part of the reason why you buy this phone. If they back out of it, that's a legal issue. That's not just mud on your face, but when your 18th different messaging platform suddenly goes to the land of ghosts and wins 3 months after you announce it.
Yeah, I agree, although part of me wants to say that I would not set the odds very high. I mean, maybe over 50%, but not much higher than that on the fact that at 5 years, Google might be like, actually, we're going to give you a coupon and toward a purchase of a new one. Or they're going to do the thing where they're like, boy, I'll put it this way. I think they're really going to regret this.
And don't trust Google either, is kind of the subtext, right?
They may stick to it. They're going to regret it. They said that there will be software updates, including features, but it doesn't mean it's all the features. And I could see it be a dwindling number of features. But you know what, Andy? You are absolutely right. I, as somebody who follows Apple stuff, want to be up on Android. And so I would buy a Nexus basically back in the day before the Pixels. Like 2 years later, I couldn't use it to stay up to date on Android because they just threw that thing to the side of the road and they just kept on going. And that's the platform vendor saying, forget it, that phone is. And that's the worst. So 7 years seems a little extreme to me, but maybe they're trying to make a point here. But it's great because you're right. Apple is essentially around five, and we say five, but the fact is Apple sells older phones for a while. And so the window of OS updates, if you're buying last year's model this year for a discount, is 1 year less. So I think Apple doesn't have a whole like planned obsolescence thing here. I don't think that's happening. Apple stands by their phones for quite a while. I think it's good enough. I think most phones don't get used for 7 years, right? Most. But, you know, my father-in-law was visiting this weekend and he's using an iPad. I don't think it's an iPad. It's like an iPad fifth generation or something with a case. It's got a case on the front that looks like it's been through a war. And it was really a moment of like, I said, gonna get a new iPad? He says, I was thinking of getting a new case, but you know, this iPad is fine.
No, exactly.
And like, I bought him a case immediately. I was like, where can I even find a case for that iPad? But like, so saying 7 years, I don't know how many of these things are even going to be in service in 7 years. And I do think Google will probably say, wow, we overshot and kind of regret it. But the bigger point is not the 7 years or the 5 years or whatever. It's that I, as somebody who bought Google phones in the past, felt incredibly frustrated by the fact that 2 years later, the new OS wouldn't run on them so bad. And I am so happy for them that they have said, no, we're not going to do that to you anymore because it's about time.
Well, and hopefully they stick with it. I mean, the hard part is that, you know, it feels like outside of display, you know, their ad business, you know, everything's a hobby, you know, and it's just, you know, Apple talks about hobbies, but it feels like everything kind of stops and starts and everything else. And I think that's the biggest challenge for Google. I mean, I think YouTube is very stable. The ad business is very stable. The docs and mail system is very stable, but everything outside of those things, it's kind of like, well, we'll see while we go.
Well, but I think that was the whole point of that 7 years was to say.
I know they say it, but they say a lot of things like that.
Flag in the sand. I know. Can you trust
them? 7 years.
I know. Yeah.
I think that's the problem. Is we've been.
We'll talk in 2040 or 30, whatever it is.
I do. I do think that's. Anything can happen, but I think it's a bit of a leap to say when they. I was looking for the weasel language because one of the things they could have done, and maybe there is a little bit of weasel language here, because the thing about Google about Android updates is that it's not all done by the Apple model, where once a year we will give you the big dog and pony, ba boom, ba boom. Hey, look, now you've got this new. Now you've got widgets, ba boom, ba boom. Hey, now the camera has this new mode, ba boom, ba boom. It's no. A lot of it is Android 14 released alongside the flagship Pixel phone, but a lot of it can be actually deployed through the Google Play Store. There are modules that it's not only being able to update the camera app or update the Maps app. It's also there's core elements of the Android system that no matter what phone you have, so long as it has a connection to the Android to the Play Store, you can even have something that's running Android that's a year or two old that will still get brand new updates, brand new features, even though it's not compatible with Android 14. So part of the weasel language could be that, oh, well, no, you can't get the Android 17 will not work on this 3-year-old or 4-year-old Pixel 8. However, you can still get that wonderful new functionality that we talked about during the keynote because it's part of a Play Store update. That's a weasel term, but it also explains that this is why it's sometimes an apples to oranges sort of thing. In terms of updates, but back to the core thing that just like Jason said, that was always one of the things where if someone is asking you a question because they're genuinely interested in maybe trying out Android, that's the one thing you have to bring up and the one thing you have no answer for, which is that, well, they're only guaranteeing 2 years or maybe actually 2.5 years of updates. Whereas with Apple, you have a good chance of having it long enough that you can pass it down to a family member or get something in the resale value for it, because by the time something gets out is old enough that you want to replace it, it's been obsoleted by Google and nobody will buy it unless they know how to root it and install custom ROMs onto it.
all the Apple people are going, ooh, now I want to take a shower talking about Android. Ew.
Well, you should be showering, Apple people. What's wrong with you?
Shower more often.
You're not 14 years old anymore.
Clean it up.
Body spray is not a shower. It's covering up the stink with another stink.
Clean it up, please. We beg you.
Jason's iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max review is out on 6 colors. Yeah. Been out for a few days.
Yeah, just took me. Well, you know, it's that thing where you get I'm not one of the people who's put under embargo, so I got the phone like the day that I got it the day before everybody else got it, right? So, and I was traveling. And you're at that moment where you're like, well, everybody who already has had it for a week has reviewed it, so that's not going to be good. I can't compete with them. And what else do I have to say? I just got it. So I decided basically to wait 2 weeks where I basically was miserable thinking, what the heck am I going to write about? And in the end, what you get is sort of like a series of small essays about what it is to use an iPhone 15 Pro is basically what I had to choose to do. But, you know, so it's something we already talked about like 2 weeks ago. But
where do you come down on the fine woven controversy?
You know, I bought a new iPhone for my wife, and she wanted that case, and I warned her about it, and she says that she likes it and that it's fine. It's right in the name. It's fine.
It's fine.
And I think it's not leather, and if for people who want leather, it's not that. I think there's a question of how customers will perceive it. I think it's a perfectly okay case. I think the question is, at Apple prices, will people be happy to pay for it or not? Is it a $60 case or not?
I got one for Lisa.
It's not.
And she's very sensitive to tactile things. She gets chills when she touches it. It like bugs her.
It's just, yeah.
So she threw it back at me.
It's got a different feel, and
it ain't leather.
It's not a substitute for leather. Yeah.
Now, in your family, does fine mean the fine? Like, in my family, fine means effed. Like we say, you know, like if you want to do something, oh, it's fine.
Oh, that's
like,
fine.
Fine does not mean.
So wait a minute. So in your family, it's good, whatever. And fine.
Good is okay. No, whatever's below fine.
Good, fine, and like, whatever.
It's the damning
whatever
with fate
is,
praise,
is pointed at
right?
you.
Good, so it's good, fine, whatever, and my bad. How about that? Those are the four.
I don't even know. My bad. I think my bad is above because it's usually that's you.
That's
right?
on
you know,
me.
Like, so the thing is that, but fine is usually, it means it's effed. You know, like it's
okay.
just like, you know,
it's
like,
fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's
it'll
fine.
Be, it'll be,
it's
we'll
not
go
good.
There,
it's
fine.
Fine. Okay.
But I'm not mad.
Fine.
I'm just disappointed.
Yeah,
that's it.
I'm just disappointed. That's it.
Yeah.
You are not disappointed with the natural titanium, I gather.
It's pretty. I mean, it's pretty. Also, it's pretty boring.
It couldn't like, be more boring. It's gray.
I think it's a nice shade, but yeah, I mean, basically what I came down in my review was saying I like titanium. I think titanium is a nice metal. I think it looks good, especially in the natural. I love that it's lighter than stainless steel. I think the stainless steel frame was a mistake. I think that for the last, whatever, 11, 12, 13, 14 generation, where there was stainless on the Pro phones and aluminum on the non-Pro phones, I think the non-Pro phones were clearly the better design all the way through.
Yeah.
Adding stainless for like shininess and bling, but having it add all of that weight, it was super unnecessary. So the titanium is great, right? It's great. And then there's the colors, and the colors are, as I've said here before, super disappointing because they're monochromatic and dull and boring. And the natural is kind of nice just because it feels like this phone is made of metal, which of course it is, but it's not offensive in any way. It's just, I just wish that they would let, the fact that their only color option is blue, which is just black with a slight blue tint, essentially. It's so like the Midnight MacBook Air. It's sort of like, oh, it's got a color if you look real close in the right light. I just wish they would let somebody have a choice about, I want a brighter, more interesting looking iPhone. And they don't, like both models this year are not like that. So yes to titanium. And I'm just disappointed. Again, it's fine. It's fine. I'm not mad, Apple. I'm just disappointed.
It's fine.
Please.
Whatever.
Make your colors more interesting. But at least it's not the stupid stainless steel that added weight for no real good reason.
There. Yeah, but it's difficult. It's difficult though because it's not just getting a color that people like, but it's also how is this color going to patina? because it's not as though they're mixing food coloring in with the batter to make it. It's always going to be a surface on top of whatever the metal is, and as it wears down, and that can actually be a very, very nice look. But other opinions could be, oh no, now it looks like it's worn and grubby. It makes me look like I can't afford to have a new phone every 8 months.
And I'm not a material scientist. I think I say that literally in the review. I say I'm not a material scientist, but I know you can anodize titanium. They chose not to do that, and anodization is a pretty rugged process for aluminum, and I believe it is for titanium as well, and the colors stay pretty well. They chose the vapor depositing approach instead, which they've used on the Apple Watch before, and I don't know how rugged it's going to be. And Dan Morin, my pal over at Six Colors, I mean, he scuffed his, and he had the black one, and there's like a big scuff mark with a lighter color underneath now. So I don't know whether the vapor, like, I can't speak to the issues around using anodization of titanium over vapor depositing on titanium. I don't know. I'm sure that Apple talked about it, but in the end, they're selling, because maybe it wouldn't look great if it was like a bright blue or something like that, but they're selling dark ones that can also wear, and they're going to reveal a lighter color underneath. So I don't know. I'm just disappointed that for whatever reason, they made decisions to lead to the point that they're all kind of monochrome.
Well, I don't know. I'd be curious. I'm sure Apple's never going to show us what the sales numbers are, but it also could be just related to the fact that, like, I look at every time Apple releases something on the Pro area, in that area, I go, oh, those are great. Those are nice colors. And then I just buy the gray one. And so I think that there could be just a lot of, you know, it may turn out that gray or different versions of gray is like 85-90% of the
color
sales.
Can be polarizing. You know, some people love pink and some people hate it. Gray, it's not, nobody loves gray. Well, wait a minute. I got a gray computer. I got a gray jacket. My car is gray. I guess I love gray. Gray is neutral. Gray, you can't they tell you when you paint, when you're going to sell your house, don't paint it red. To be neutral with it.
Right, because people have opinions about red.
People have
opinions about gray. Well, choice, like, wouldn't it be nice if there was some choice there? But I actually, and this seems ridiculous, but I think it's true. When Apple did the blue and white G3 back in the 90s, everybody, all the pros complained because they wanted a neutral colored workstation. Right. And I feel like literally that was the lesson that Apple integrated into their soul at that moment, which is
that was
only gray computers for the pros from now on. Only
it's your fault, Alex. You're the 30% gray man.
I literally 18% gray.
I'm sorry,
but 18.
Gray Alex.
I literally, when I go into an office, when we move into a new office, I just hand them a gray card, and I just need the walls to look like this gray card. And that's kind of for anybody who does color work, it is what you think, you know, pretty quickly. So then all of our apps are all gray, and all of our, you know, like there's definitely
safe.
A style there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's safe.
So,
titanium. It's interesting because titanium, I don't think that titanium is a big deal, but clearly Apple thinks it's a big deal. And I can't decide whether it's because they don't really have much else to say, or they think people will go, oh, titanium. And I've heard even people say, oh yeah, the titanium phone, like it's sinking in.
It's branding. I think it's good branding, right? They did it already with that PowerBook back in the day. Like, it is a fun word. It's new. It's a new material.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, we nerds can poo-poo it and say, like, all the only element that really matters is silicon, and it's on the inside and the chips. So give me those chips. But the truth is, like, it's a consumer good. Some people care about the finish and the. I mean, I just spent time complaining about colors, right? People care about the finish, or a particular metal, and they like the idea of it. I think it does sell their, like, it maybe feels a little bit lighter. I think that's part of the message. But clearly all the marketing is just like titanium. It came from space, and now we made a phone out of it.
From space.
And it's, you know, it is marketing, but also what isn't?
Well, yeah, because I hate to be the one to point this out, but we're in space right now. We're all from space.
We all came from space.
Also in space. This is true. Good point.
We're not from space. We're in space.
We are space.
Space right now.
Yeah, a planet.
We are stardust.
Space.
We are
giant
golden.
Spaceship.
It's just true.
Action button is the other unique and different feature. And I think the jury's still out whether that was an improvement over the silence switch. Out of curiosity, where do you
leave?
Where is your action button set? What is the action?
I think I said it last week. I'm on. I have a shortcut that does dictation.
Oh, that's right. You did say that.
List.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're still there.
But
huh?
I'm all in on it because I feel like the number of wizards who could feel in their pocket exactly where the switch was positioned without flipping it back
that's
and
true.
Forth to make sure
that's
is
true.
This tiny amount of people. Plus, surely that I'm not saying I'm the majority, but surely a lot of people are like me and they just left it in silent all the time.
Right. And that's the
it's
default,
a wasted
by the
piece
way.
Of hardware,
if,
then.
If you don't change it, which probably 90% of people are not going to change it, then it is a silence button. I did what they did on iOS today where they made a shortcuts folder that opens up. So I have a few
yeah,
other
like
actions.
That.
Yeah, it's a second step. And one of them is set silent. Yeah. One of them is dictate because I like your idea. I'm dictating to drafts. If I could
that
dictate
works.
To my PKMS to Logseq, I would. But I think I can, but.
Probably
Apple
could.
Script is really strange.
With a tricky shortcut, you could probably build
there's
a thing
yeah.
to send to their
you
web
know,
server.
No, I think I can do it because there's dictate to text, which is, I guess, what you're using. Mm-hmm. And then you can take the dictated text and append it to the today's daily journal file because that's a plain text markup
yep.
file. It's just appending the text is weird in Apple Script. It's not just opening a file and writing it. It's there's a couple of weird steps.
Right, but in shortcuts you can do
I'll
it.
Have to
it's,
learn
it's not too bad.
I have
it's
to
not
learn
too bad.
How shortcuts
I just
works.
I mean I have opinions. That's why I wrote a review, but like I feel like if you're everybody should do what they want and what makes them feel happy. However,
yes.
I think what's great about the action button is that it's hardware and it can be muscle memory. And if it's hardware that just brings up a thing you have to look at and tap on the screen,
that's
what
not
are
as
we
good.
Even doing here?
Yeah.
It's like it's about hardware. That's why I think maybe the best application for most people of the action button is the camera thing. Because although everybody said, oh, yeah, you can tap on the screen, you can swipe, you can do all those things, that muscle memory of taking it out of your pocket and pressing the button and the camera's there and then you go click, click, click on that button
yeah.
is like it's all hardware. You don't have to think about any of the software. You're just using your phone as a camera at that point. I think that's really powerful. But the all of these other things, I think the beauty in it is it's a button you can put your thumb on and just go, boom,
yeah.
a thing is going to happen on my iPhone. I think that's
so
the power of the action
so
button.
So I'm foolish to do that. Their Halide, which
if
is my favorite camera app, does have a Halide action. So you can press it,
yep.
long press it, and then Halide launches. And then if you press it again, it chooses between different lenses, which is kind of slick.
Yeah.
So Halide. So yep. apparently apps can be switch action
so
switch
it,
aware. Action button
it
aware.
Seems like the trick is if your action button is that app and you're in that app, the app knows that you're in that app.
Yeah.
So then it will do a thing that you determine to do in that app. So it's like it's not quite like apps can take it over. It's more like the
they
app
can,
knows
they can
that
see
the
it.
Action button.
It's an event.
Because it's the app that's the recipient of the action button, it knows that it got
right.
pushed again
right.
and can do something then.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, so yeah. I would love it to have a Pokemon Go. It would open Pokemon Go, and then if I press it again, it catches a Pokemon. There you go. Now we're talking. That's what I call right. action.
Yeah, and also there are a bunch of people who are using the Tesla app is taking advantage of it, so you can program the side
start
button to basically be your car, your door unlock, the front unlock thing. So,
yeah
I mean, exactly. I you know, even when I had a car, I wouldn't care. Okay, I have more important things to do that one programmable button than to unlock my car. But yeah, again, people want what they want, and now they can have not what they want, but part of what they want.
Soon you'll be able to have ChatGPT. You can have it dictate to ChatGPT, but soon you'll be able to have ChatGPT respond. And so that might become the smart assistant
yeah.
button, which would be kind of it. That's the problem is there's several things I would like to do. I can't decide. That's why I have a folder.
You know, it's weird. Like somewhere in my archives, I still have my Amazon Fire Phone that Amazon did not want back after the review period.
Yeah. There was such, you can keep that, Andy. Flavor. It's our gift to you.
Yeah. Please, yes. it's not worth us spending $21 to have it shipped back to us.
Yeah.
But there were so many really neat ideas in that keep coming back. And one of them was, hey, there's a dedicated button that is just the what is this button, where if you press this button, whatever is on the screen, we will I don't think it was a sophisticated AI, but we will try to figure out what it is that you're looking at or what it is that this camera is pointing at, and it will explain it to you. And that's one of the most interesting things that that custom button can do, particularly with ChatGPT, particularly if there are more apps like Google Lens coming out there. Because I mean, I got to tell you, one of the this isn't the Android show, but one of the things that I would love to see, like an iPhone. This is on my mind because now that there's a brand new version of iOS, I'm back on iPhone for the next like 2 or 3 weeks, like to get back immersiveness. And one of the things that I miss is still the ability to swipe up and then simply say, whatever it is on the screen, help me with it. And like, oh, there's a URL that I can't highlight, but highlight that for me and then tape me that URL. Or, hey, you see this address? Map this address for me. Or just tell me more about this picture. I think there's something more I want to know about it that's not in the article. And so, yeah, that ability to simply say, not just in the domain of what you're looking at on the phone, but in the world, to say that go way beyond, hey, what does this restaurant sign say? Because it's in a language I don't understand. But simply be able to say, hey, what kind of a tree is this? Or, ooh, there's this weird bug I just saw in my house. What kind of a bug is this? And what do I should I encourage more of them to come in, or should I try to herd them out? That sort of stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of potential there, and I hope that with AI is now entering its second phase, where it's past the cool demo phase. And now people are actually trying to ask, well, what does it actually do for me, except for threaten my job? And this is one of the areas inside a mobile phone where it can absolutely be a big help to just about anybody.
What are you putting your action button at?
I'm leaning towards a shortcut right now. I've got it set up for basically what Jason has done, essentially capture ideas, capture information, and to basically put it inside notes or put it inside.
So it actually becomes like a little personal voice recorder. I think that's kind of a nice way to do it, actually.
Because especially because when you have an idea in your head, you need zero distractions to make sure it doesn't get knocked out of your head before you wake up the phone, launch the app, create a new note, categorize it. I don't know what it was.
Right.
So the ability to simply tap a button, speak, and then go on with your life without even looking at the screen, that's a pretty big win.
This is actually big for drafts, because drafts lets you capture it and then later, at a later time, maybe at the end of the day, decide what to do with it, where to put it. And that's kind of a nice way to do that.
That's great. And I heard, after we talked about this last week, I heard from some people who are like, well, why not just use Siri for that? And my answer is, first off, you have to make sure that the trigger works right. And like, it's all what Andy said, which is, it's more things that are in your way. And yeah, if I'm out for a run, I will talk to Siri and tell it to remind me to, and then the name of an idea, which is a weird construction.
Yeah.
But as Andy pointed out, the fewer steps in between you and your idea and getting it down, the better. So the action button, all you do is press the button and say, write about this thing, and let go, and done. And it's transcribed, put in my case, it's in reminders in a very specific list, but it could be any app that supports shortcuts. And it's not that you can't do it some other way. It's what Andy said, which is, if you can remove as many impediments between you and getting it down, you're less likely to forget it or mess it up. Or just the act of having to think, like, how do I phrase this to get it to Siri, can mess up your idea. And because your brain is processing it as like you're talking to another person, and it's not grammatically correct what you have to say. And I find myself stumbling on this perfectly clear idea I had just because I had to say, hey, dingus, remind me to, and then a story idea.
Yeah, just to say nothing of the fact that the easier it is, the fewer steps there are, the more you'll actually start narrowing down ideas, as opposed to, oh, I can't reach my phone right now. Okay, I'll remember that later. It really is the stupid ideas that you thought were not worth writing down that 3 days later, when like you go, okay, I need to write something today. Oh, that's a great idea. Oh, like, and it was like, really? Like, what kind of a hat would a duck wear if it had to put the hat on itself? That really was a great idea. Like, no, seriously.
Actually, it's a key part of the getting things done methodology as well, is to dump those ideas out as soon as possible into a trusted system. But our Discord has figured out, by the way, what kind of hat a duck would wear if it could wear a hat.
That is adorable. What the thought was like, what if the duck had to put the hat on itself?
This had human assistance, and that's not.
So it would have to be something where they have to be able to like sort of duck underneath the hat.
I'm thinking that would be.
Oh, sorry again. No opposition, exactly.
Andy, go tell your phone.
Brilliant ideas that get lost by the wayside.
Go tell your phone because I'm so genius that I can't.
I don't even see them coming.
I think the duck wouldn't want to duck under the hat because then it would look like a quack.
We're going to, on that fine note, take a little break. And when we come back, iOS 17.1, which is coming, does change a little
bit. The effort is appreciated.
Yeah, it is. The effort is appreciated.
There are.
Fine, Alex.
Fine.
It was fine. This episode of MacBrain Weekly is brought to you by my latest find, which is absolutely awesome, Mylio, M-Y-L-I-O. They call it Mylio Photos, but really it's not just for photos, it's for documents too. It's digital information management done right. Maybe start with photos and videos. Think about that. We are all looking for ways to keep track of all of our photos in all of the places, you know, not just on the computer, but on your phone, on Instagram, on Flickr. This is what Mylio does. It takes all of your photos, organizes them, makes it easy to edit them, makes it easy to find them because it has very sophisticated smart tagging. It finds people. So I pick, you know, some people that I wanted to keep track of, and then it goes through all of my photos. I now have 200,000 photos. And by the way, I know those are unduplicated photos in Mylio because what I did is I imported from everywhere, including I did a Google takeout, and it reads Google takeout files natively. And then I said dedupe, and it has a very, very, very good deduplicator. So I know that each of those 200,000 plus photos in Mylio is unique. Now I have access to them everywhere, on my phone, on my desktop. And with the power of AI, those smart tags mean you don't have to search kind of aimlessly or scroll through images, whether you're looking for objects, activities, animals, plants, colors. It does it all automatically. It's really, really fantastic. And with the Mylio Photos Plus subscription, all your devices are connected in one library. Plus, you don't have to use a public cloud to back up your Mylio data. Mylio is not selling cloud storage. No. In fact, it's not even selling this. It's free. But Mylio Photos Plus will currently back up to Microsoft OneDrive, Google Drive, any S3 compatible cloud service, Backblaze B2 or Wasabi, or of course, Amazon. I back it up to my Synology NAS. It works with lots of different NASs, which is nice because I am now, without putting all my photos in the cloud, I am now keeping them backed up and organized. Okay. This is really a great solution. That, by the way, does require Mylio Photos Plus. But I want you just, you know, it's a free download to just put Mylio on your device, whether your computer or your mobile device, and start importing photos just so you can see what Mylio can do. And they're always adding new features. A bunch of new features just came out. And if you've been as my wife does, using Instagram as your photo album for years, it can import them all into Mylio. So you haven't lost them. They're there. And they will always be yours, no matter what happens to Insta. Don't wait. The solution to digital management exists. Mylio.com/twit. Please do yourself a favor. This is the solution I've been looking for ever since Picasa went away, really, more than a decade. Mylio.com/twit. And it's free. But you may want to take a look at Mylio Photos Plus for some additional features. Mylio Photos, free today on your computer or mobile device. Mylio.com/twit. Download it for free. Mylio.com/twit. And if you do want to put it on, it supports all the clouds. It has an encryption feature, so you encrypt before you put it up on Google Drive or iCloud or OneDrive. And that's nice, too, because you know it's there, it's backed up, but no one can see it except you because it's strong encryption. Mylio.com. I keep going on. I could do this ad for hours. There's so many features. Just try it. Mylio.com/twit. It's a life saver. Scott and LV says, I love Mylio. Thank you, Scott, in our Discord. So apparently, Action Button's going to get a new behavior in 17.1. Are you using 17.1 yet, Mr. Snell? No.
No. I'm enjoying my brief time not
without a beta. I know. I kind of like it.
Yes.
I kind of like it. Apple has
every time something goes wrong, it's your fault. It's, you know, it's a tough time. It's a tough time.
There is a public, I guess it's public. Maybe it's developers. Is it developer? Or is there a public beta already? I think it is public because my phone, when I set it up, said, do you want to stay in the beta channel? I said, no. No. So 17.1, watchOS 10.1, tvOS 17.1, macOS 14.1. But 9 to 5 Mac found something in the third beta, which just came out of iOS 17.1. Apple is tweaking the Apple action button on the iPhone 15 Pro. It detects when the phone's in your pocket using the proximity sensors. And if it is, then you'll have to press the button longer to trigger the action. This is to keep it, I guess they found some people, it was going off by accident in their pocket. So you have to press it a little bit longer.
I feel like there's a lot of things that go on by accident on
in
my
pocket.
iPhone now. Like,
I know.
Yeah. No, it's like it calls people. It you know, it does things really. I think Apple has leaned a little too far towards responsiveness, where I look down and I picked up my phone and somehow I'm calling the last person I called.
Do you think turning off
a random person
Siri would just help? Maybe not.
I don't think it's Siri that's doing it. I think it's some kind of like I'm touching
touches,
some part of it.
Accidental
but it just,
touches.
But yeah. It just feels like it's like I don't. And the other thing that I've noticed in 17 is that I don't trust it as much to say the right words. Like I'm typing. I feel like there's a lot of, I feel like I'm typing the same way, but I'm getting a lot more typos.
Hmm.
Like it's not, its attempt to write ahead of me is less successful than it was before. You know, which is, seems like it's going backwards.
Well, there's two things. So they got the new language model in there. Which should be
working.
Better.
But it should be.
But there's two things, right? There's a baked-in model, and then there's the learning your preferences. So some aspect of it might actually improve over time, that it learns how you type and what you type and what words you use, and that is actually being used to supplement some of the changes
right.
that are going on. So it might get better over time, or it might yeah. not. I found that it's better, but not as much better as I had hoped it would be when they announced it.
Yeah. You talked about, and John Gruber loved it, using the new UWB feature to find your wife at a fair.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's right. Find my loved ones is a new feature. Yeah, so ultra wideband is a really great technology, and it's a slow burn, right? Because it kind of needs to be everywhere. And there's going to come a moment, maybe later this decade, where almost everything has a UWB chip of some kind in it. And what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, when Bluetooth is detecting proximity, it's doing it by basically a hack where it's looking at the strength of the radio signal and using it as a proxy for distance, which can lead to some problems like a signal booster from a restaurant out to the parking lot to make your car think that you have approached it and it unlocks the doors and then they can get in and drive it, right? UWB doesn't do any of that. UWB is precise 3D positioning in space. It can't be boosted like that. And it leads to a whole bunch of interesting things, including in the future, like your smart lock on your front door will know when you're walking up to your door and can unlock, but it'll also know when you're on the other side of it and you're near it. And this right now with Bluetooth, you have to have all these weird hacks because like sometimes you're near the door on the inside and it shouldn't unlock the door then. It should only do it on the outside. Bluetooth doesn't know. So you have to have like with a lot of smart locks with Bluetooth, you have to like leave your house and then it arms. And so then when it sees you again, then it unlocks the door. But then until you leave again, it doesn't do it. UWB solves all of that. You are going to eventually the dream of like walking into a room and having the lights come on and stuff because it knows you're present. UWB will enable that. What Apple has done with iOS 17 and with the new UWB chip that they're not calling the U2. No. We're not going to call it that. My review has like 18 U2 song title references in it because I just decided to. I'm like, why? Why does it not have this?
Why not?
Anyway, but it does have this Find My feature where if you're looking for somebody else with an iPhone 15, and my wife has an iPhone 15, I lost her at the football game.
You're at the Cal game.
She was going.
Yeah.
Like I was going to the bathroom and she was going to the concessions and then there was like we were going to meet here, but one person didn't hear it. And so she texts and she's like, where are you? And I said, you must have walked right past me. And I thought, oh, I can try this feature. And it's really great. So you say like this person is nearby. It knows from Find My. It's already a Find My person, right? She's already in my Find My list. And I'm like, oh, she's really close. And it switches into this like precision finding mode that is a lot like finding an AirTag or something like that. And she got a little alert that said, Jason's looking for you.
That's key, by the way, is it's not just you looking for her. It tells her that you're using the Find My to find her. Yeah, I think that's important.
She can bring it up, and she can bring it up too, because the goal there is that you're trying to
find each other. Yeah.
And it was like, I'm going to go to the right, and it's like she's 10 feet ahead.
Wow.
And then it's like, oh, and then we were there. And I said, oh, that was fun. Right. It was just a little thing. But I thought this is a really cool feature. And it shows it's finally like one of these examples where you're like, oh, ultra wideband. This is why it's going to be really a game changer. But it's going to take a while, and it's going to be a little subtle at first. But like, once we know that people and devices are exactly this point in space, it does allow stupid computers to do things that they can't do now, because they just don't sense like humans do.
Yeah. And inside, there's a big challenge where, so if you have, and we haven't really seen people take advantage of the ability to use either the trackers or other ultra wideband chip based systems to start figuring out exactly where you are. I mean, I think that Apple hasn't opened that up enough yet, but I think a lot of us see the possibility of, once I get you inside a building, GPS is not particularly useful, and the best I can do with Bluetooth is usually about 3 to 5 feet, and some people would say 10 feet reliably. And so I've got this big space that I got to figure out, especially when it comes to AR. I got to figure out this big space that I can't quite get my arms around. And so if I can get you down to, I think that the ball that ultra wideband gets you down to is less than a foot in diameter. Once I do that, that gives me a very small search area. And if I use your phone, so if I point my phone out and I use that camera and I hash the location that I'm inside of, so I have key elements that are out there that I can look at, I can know exactly where you are to the millimeter, like to where your phone is to the millimeter. Because as soon as I see a little bit of that. Because right now, a lot of the AR stuff, I mean, we see this persistence that Apple's talked about in the past, but it still has to kind of figure out where you are in the world. If this tells you if we know where you are in the world, and then we add this last little bit of tracking, it means that we can paint the walls whatever we want. We can give you directions to the restaurant that you want to go to, or to the restrooms, or to whatever you want to do. We can change the entire environment you're in. And those are really powerful with or without the vision stuff. Just with your phone, they can give you an entirely different experience. And where that, where you can do things like, you think of a Taylor Swift show or an Elton John show, being able to walk in and be in the lobby and know that there's an AR experience. You pick up your phone, you start looking around, and you see someone playing, or you see things happening all over it as you walk into something that you become part of. And those things are, and once you have a scan of the venue, or you've modeled it and put the correct hashes in, you could do that, but you need the ultra wideband to make it work. Like, it's not, it's very, very hard to search a 10 foot radius, and actually know, have enough information to do it in a reliably quick way. This is instant.
Jason, you put it exactly right. It's not the sort of thing that makes it to the top of the list in the event video, but it is such an enabling technology. The story that you told is exactly the sort of thing that makes people happy they upgraded their phone. Because they didn't buy it for this feature, but once they realize that, oh, wait, there is a solution for this, and the solution really, really works well, that's when you realize that, oh, my old phone couldn't do that. I'm so happy that I stuck with the iPhone and bought and upgraded this year. And the number of things that can be done with it, like proximity is an obnoxious and very, very coarse sort of thing for Bluetooth to read. Like, it's no good for me to know that I was within proximity of this device or this person. If with this technology, it can do things like, again, with the consent of everybody involved, like, no, I can actually tell the software, the hardware can actually tell that, no, you two actually walked to become close to each other. You were facing each other and you stayed facing each other for 2 or 3 feet apart for a good 15 to 20 minutes. it is therefore likely that you had a substantive conversation. And therefore, if, again, with the permission of all involved, if you want to, if you're at a meeting or a conference and you want to simply remember, who was that person I talked to like three weeks ago at that time, we talked about this. They weren't supposed to talk to me about this, but they definitely said that, yes, I know a lot about that. And I'm vengeful. So yes, hit me up sometime later on that. Oh yeah, that's the person I talked to. It's that sort of stuff. And yes, leave it to me to come up with a really, really creepy sort of surveillance-y sort of thing. As opposed to I was separated from my loved one, but
I like that much better, to be honest with you. But okay.
It's this idea that, I mean, when I said the computers and our devices are dumb, I mean, sensory wise, they are dumb, right? They're good cameras, but like they don't really know. And so we don't think about it a lot, but we've internalized this like proxy of radio attenuation as location awareness in devices. And it's not very good. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of times when we have to rely on that, we think this stupid thing doesn't know what it's doing, is because it's actually very cleverly trying to say, oh, the Bluetooth radio signal is weaker, so it must be further away. But it's a hack. It's not made for it. UWB is made for it. That was the whole point of it. And it does have, I'll give you another less creepy example maybe, which is there are a lot of cars that are pretty intelligent now. And sometimes you've got your key on your phone. It's all based on Bluetooth, but it's all going to UWB. And for example, if you're getting in a car and your loved one is getting in the car with you in the two front seats, and one of you opens the door before the other one, right now, what most cars do is say, whoever had the stronger Bluetooth signal when they open the door is the driver. And it if it's got a self-adjusting seat or seats, it'll do all of that. With UWB, it knows who's sitting in the driver's seat, right? And who's in the passenger seat.
That would be
And it can
huge.
Make judgments based on it, right? And it's a little thing, right? It's little.
No, but Lisa but always gets in the car first, and the car's all set up
exactly.
wrong.
Exactly. It's set up for her. So, and with 17, one of the features in iOS 17 is if you walk up to like a HomePod or something, it says, oh, you're by the HomePod. Would you like to transfer the music you're playing to the HomePod? Well, that's UWB. There's UWB in the HomePod Mini and the second generation HomePod. And so your phone, if you've got a UWB chip in it, which is since like the 12 or something, it knows that you're close to it. It isn't guessing based on Bluetooth that might be further away. It knows you're right by the HomePod, and it makes a difference because suddenly your device that you think is so smart but actually about location is really stupid.
Well, it's a classic.
It's smart.
This is a classic complaint, is Bluetooth, inadvertent Bluetooth handoffs. There was a guy on Reddit this morning who said, every time my wife pulls into the garage, I'm in the living room. My phone takes over on her car, and she's suddenly hearing what I'm listening to.
Leo, every time my wife, she usually leaves in the morning, but sometimes she works a little bit later. She pulls out of the driveway while I'm sitting at my desk in the garage, and my computer and all my devices go into do not disturb while driving.
That's
is happening?
Yeah.
But I'm just close enough somehow.
We got to fix this. Yeah, maybe UWB can fix this.
You're driving now. I'm sitting in a Mac studio, people. I'm not driving, but it doesn't know. It's dumb. It doesn't know.
It's so great when you see like a company like Apple, who has the most creative and the most talented and smartest people. Like they get the top talent, and yet like either they or their management are so excited about a feature that they don't care that it doesn't work. Absolutely. That's going to drive people nuts 5% of the time. So it's not 6% of the time.
But when you sell a billion devices, 5% of the time adds up.
I'm saying that like that's how we come to appreciate like when every single time the bane of all of our existences. I made the grave error of using an iPad like on a commuter rail train or Amtrak train, and it keeps asking me every 5 minutes, do you want to connect with this pair of headphones it just saw. Or I still remember one of the funniest like engineering fails that was like totally. I was it was one of the first iPhones that I had. I had it in a car dock, and like it just kept screwing up like in the most random and weird ways. And I was getting more and more frustrated because it was. And of course, you're driving, so I can't like take my hands off the wheel. Like, I was on the highway. I couldn't pull over. I also couldn't take the hands off. So it just kept screwing up everything. And it wasn't until like I got home and like considered throwing it in a lake that I realized that. Oh, it's the shake to undo feature. So every time I hit a bump, we think, oh, just undo the last thing that happened, which is, oh, so you don't want to navigate anymore. Yes, I do. I'm in Massachusetts. There are potholes.
That's funny. That was enough to shake it, huh?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And it's trying to turn off, like, shake to undo, and suddenly, like, it regained its senses. But yeah, so when you see something like a new Bluetooth that says, actually, all the stuff, I want to be able to unlock the door when I approach it. Okay. But it's going to screw up sometimes because we're just really trying to make this do something. It was real. You know, ask Bluetooth to connect to a pair of headphones because, oh my God, it is really good at that. Don't make me the basis of your whole security system about how I detect who you are and where you are. It's just exciting when you see technology like this, particularly on a mobile, like I said before, on a mobile device. It's part of it, is your inter, it helps your interface with the entire world without blocking your continuity between your brain and the world. And so the ability to do this and basically take a lot of the cognitive load off your head is just such a breathtaking thing.
You do another good thing, which I like, which is you have an upgrade diagnosis. I don't know. Is this new to your reviews?
I used to write a second story that was sort of like, if you're upgrading from, here's what you need, here's what's new. And I just decided at this point to just tack it on to the end of that story. So yeah, I did a, like, how fast is this phone compared to the 14 Pro, 13 Pro, 12 Pro, 11 Pro? And also sort of in the text basically said, all right, if you're coming from the 11 Pro, you'll get these features plus everything that, you know, that's in the next section. If you're coming from the 12 Pro, you'll get these features. And it's, so the idea there is you're collecting up, because if you're coming from the 12 Pro, you're not just getting the 15 Pro new features. You're getting all the new features in the 14 Pro and the 13 Pro too. So I tried to stack it up a little bit because, you know, we as reviewers are really focused on what's new since last year, which is understandable and good. And if you're going to write it one way, that's got to be the way it is. But the truth is, if you're coming from a 3-year-old phone, what's new in the 15 is not what you want to read. You want to read what's new in the 14 and the 13 too.
Sorry, I'm just looking at my phone so I can scan my...
Just taking a picture.
Well, driver's license in the phone. California finally lets us to get our driver's license in our iPhone. Oh.
Oh, it's doing a little face verification there.
Yeah, it's to
wild.
See if I'm alive. So yeah, apparently,
if you're a picture or not.
I am alive. I don't know what all those flashing colors were.
Yeah, when we went to New Zealand, the New Zealand visa, that's what they did. It's the same technology. It's this, like, prove that your face is not a picture being held up against the camera and stuff like that.
I guess that was what it was. Yeah.
That you're a real person.
It was used. What's nice is it uses the, it looked like it was using the depth scan in the, in the iPhone's selfie cam, which is pretty cool. So this is another new feature, relatively new. It's been around. I said, Lisa, I can get my iPhone to have my app, my wallet. And she said, I did that weeks ago. Okay, well, I finally saw it. Yeah. But one thing I did notice, when I get a new phone, it doesn't carry over. So you got to redo it, I guess, with a new phone. I don't know if you know or care about that. This is, California is not doing what other states are doing. They have their own app, which is always a bad idea. Come on.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yep.
Come on. You're not going to write an app as good as Apple. Come on. Don't even.
But we talk about philosophically how, like, corporations have the power of nations. It's like, in this area, it's like, I find myself explicitly asking myself the question, who do I trust with my personal information?
Yeah.
Apple? Or my state
or
government.
DMV. Like, yeah.
I have written the MBTA this summer. I trust Apple with my personal information more than I trust my state government.
Well, and I think that's the problem. Is every time you sit in the DMV, it erodes your
confidence.
What you think is possible here. Yeah. So,
well, anyway, I'm giving them my image, and we'll see. I guess a human then looks at it, because you have to scan the front and the back of your card.
Yeah,
human gotta looks be approved. At it, and then it's
and then you
be
can
in,
use
like,
it in
very
some
few places.
Airports.
Yeah, I want to use it. Next time I fly.
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break. There's another review that's worth paying attention to. Came out Wednesday. Sebastian DeWitt's view of the camera, the halide guy. And he talks about some interesting points that I think we might be willing to mention. I also like to get your thoughts on the camera. But first, a word from our sponsor. What a great show. It's always fun to join together. I look forward to Tuesdays because I'm going to see Jason and Andy and Alex. And
me too.
We're going to get together. have a good time. Our show today brought to you by ZocDoc. You know that feeling when you get the thing you've been looking for on the internet, the perfect thing you spend hours researching, you read all the reviews, you make a pros and cons list, you finally get it, right? You got the perfect one, the sparkly disco pants or the designer dog hoodie or whatever it is you're looking for. Five stars, arrives in 48 hours. Isn't it weird that we can do that for disco pants, but we can't do it for a physician? Why is it you can get those things, you know, in overnight, but if you want to see a good doctor, you know, how do you know they're good? Where's the reviews? And it might take forever to get an appointment. This is why you want ZocDoc. It's an app you can put on your phone, and it's good to have all the time. A place to find and book great doctors who have amazing reviews. Many of them available within 24 hours. You can filter it down by who takes your insurance, what their specialties are. It's not just MDs. It's chiropractors. It's dentists. It's a variety of disciplines. It is incredible. And by the way, it's free. ZocDoc is a free app where you can find amazing doctors and book appointments online. We're talking about booking appointments with thousands of top-rated patient-reviewed doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for those who take your insurance or located near you, who treat whatever condition you're looking for. Dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, OBGYN, they're all in there. Now, I have to say, there are also doctors have different styles, and the reviews are really important. By the way, these are verified actual reviews from actual real patients. They're very careful about that. And so you can look at a doctor and say, well, that doctor is just right, but let me look at the reviews, because there are different styles. Some doctors have this great bedside manner and are really good with patients. Some doctors are very focused, and a lot of us geeks like this, on facts. And let me make the decision. I want all the facts. Sometimes some people, and many of us, just want a doctor that just tells us the one thing to do. I don't want to need to know all the different choices. That's too confusing. So this is how you find out if that doctor has a style you want as well. They take your insurance, and they're the kind of doctor you're looking for. The average wait for a doctor booked on ZocDoc, between 24 and 48 hours. That's all. In fact, in some cases, you can even get same-day appointments. So if you're not feeling well, you don't want to wait. That's a nice thing to have. Once you find the doc you want, book them immediately with just a few app taps. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. Can you tell me exactly what the skin condition is, please? Go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak and download the app for free. I know you know that you could go to the app store and just get it. And, you know, if you want to, okay. But it would be really nice if you go to the website so they know you saw it here. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. Find and book a top-rated doctor today. You really do want this on your phone. Although you can do it also on the website. That's where I've done the website search many times. Well, not many times. How often do I need a doctor? A few times. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. You know, when you need a doc, you want to find him fast or her. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. We thank him so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Always get excited when I see Sebastian DeWitt weighing in. By the way, they've really been good at immediate support for the iPhone 15 Pro Max with Halide. As I mentioned, the action buttons work with it. He does a really good... This is more not as much a review, I would say, as... A helpful tool for iPhone photographers on what the different lenses do and how you should be thinking about composition and stuff. It's really a primer in photography,
it's an experiential review. It's not about, hey, look, the lenses, the sensors are the same, but the lenses have new coatings. Hey, I noticed that there was an X micron shift in whatever. It's more like... You have someone who not only is a developer of what is the de facto official professional photography app for the iPhone, the most popular pocket camera in the entire world, but also an avid photographer themselves.
So, and a very good photographer, by the way. I love his shots.
Exactly. And this is why this annual piece is so valuable, because it's not, again, it's not, hey, and I took some test shots here during a half hour of the sidewalk just outside my office. No, this is someone who has experience, who's going to carry this around and treat it like a real camera. It really does show in the work.
It's helpful too because he understands how the iPhone gets the shots that it gets, and so he's giving you information that Apple does not give you about what's going on when it's doing a night shot or when you're going into macro mode and so forth. So night mode, for instance, combines pixels for higher light sensitivity, but you only get 12 megapixels no matter what format you're capturing it in. This is useful, right? Because now you know what you're going to get. He talks about pro raw file sizes. I've been wondering, well, should I use the compressed, you know, high efficiency formats, or should I use the native raw format? What should I do? He also talks about the 5X telephoto and says you really have to think about what you're looking at to use it. And I think that's true of any, if you're going to shoot exclusively telephoto, that's true because you're very much narrowing the field of view.
Yeah, it's not just about being at the sidelines at a kid's soccer game and being able to take closer photos of your kid, although that's very, very
good. That's part of it.
It's also, it's also about like just take, hey, here's a nice, I'm taking a walk. Here's a very nice like little landscapey thing. And ooh, I like the bushes that are kind of like in front of the lake and with the house in the distance. It's the ability, it's the thought of, ooh, if I were to take like 10 steps back and shoot this with the telephoto, suddenly the foreground and the background and the flake will all look like they're part of the same thing. That's the sort of thought that you have, that these sort of telephoto lenses open up for you in mobile photography.
He likes, and I had never really thought about that. He prefers shooting with the ultra wide, which I probably never would have thought of, to be honest.
He made the good point that you almost don't have to aim anymore,
right?
Which is a really good point because the new AI generative tools in Photoshop, notwithstanding, if it's not in the frame, who cares? Like if the thing that needed to be part of the picture got cut off, then you lose. You may as well. So in so many situations, you may as well shoot ultra wide. If you're at a party or if things are happening kind of fast and you're not really sure that you're going to be able to react and move the camera and recompose very quickly. Yeah. And the fact that Apple has made the super wide like that much better makes it even more imperative to have this idea in your head that, ooh, I know that this is the artist's entrance outside the theater. I know that I'm going to maybe have like 30 seconds to get a picture of someone coming out of the venue after the play. I'm going to go ultra wide because that way I know that if the actor like hugs somebody or says something or gives someone a high five, I'm going to get the whole high five and not just some arms that got cut off from the bottom.
Right. He also says the telephoto lens is really sharp. Lots of detail, best yet, which I guess we'd expect. You, on your review, Jason, showed that if you go beyond the optical zoom, though, you can really get some weird smeary.
Yeah, don't do it. I'm not trying to create a gate here. Basically, what I'm saying is, even with a 5X, it'll let you go to 20X, but you know, don't do it. And if you do it, don't zoom in because it's doing some things to try and smooth everything out. And faces get real weird if you zoom in on them. You're like, ooh, what is wrong with that person? And the answer is, it's a 20X digital zoom is what's wrong with that person. Don't do it. So it's just like I think that getting the extra makes you more excited about like I could go even further. And don't, right? Like actually, Apple's processing is so good that if you go to 7 or 10X on the 5X and the Pro Max, it still looks pretty good, like shockingly good. But if you push it, it will all start to break down. And that's just the nature of it. There is no more information for them to use there. They're just guessing.
Yeah, I shot my kids on a stage at high school. You know, they're playing in their bands. And I shot at about 10X from a pretty far distance. And it was not as good as if I had been closer up. But it wasn't bad. And I was kind of amazed that I was holding up a phone at 10X with them that close. I mean, imagine being, not in the front row, like 10, 15 rows back, and then shooting someone on the back of the stage and getting pretty much a head-to-toe shot. And the stabilization is kind of amazing. Like, you just see this little leg.
Well, that's another thing he says. You normally with a 5X, it'd be very hard to hand hold, especially at night.
Yeah.
And he says it does a great job. Yeah.
Yeah. Although he does caution that, that's another difference between if you're using telephoto if you're not in really good lighting, you may want to just back off because you'll get less lens blur. It's one of the hardest things for me to learn because all of us in this conversation, we've been using digital cameras since like almost the very beginning. And so one of the hardest things for me to unlearn was, it's okay to use digital zoom because the computational photography modes in iPhones and other like super high like flagship cameras, it's going to be better than simply shooting with the normal lens and then blowing it up in Photoshop or blowing it up in whatever the image editor is, because you can practically go 2x without really it costing you a whole lot, given that you're already shooting with a camera, with a phone camera anyway. ISO is the other thing to learn. But yeah, that's the sort of thing where don't be afraid to test out the digital zoom. Although an app like Haylight is really nice to be able to say that, hey, I don't want you to ever use digital zoom. I'm a connoisseur. Just lock me into whatever the natural focal lengths are.
I have been accepted. The state of California has allowed me to join them in the state, and I have a driver's license in the phone now. I have never used this. I like to share my... We talked about it before, but because I have a new phone, I had to move it over, and it didn't move over. You had to just do the process again. John Ricciatiello, is that how you say his name? Maybe you knew him as the CEO of Unity. Not so fast, bucko. This has ended up being a calamity for Unity. You may remember they suggested that they would change their pricing and retroactively start charging developers for every install of games or apps using Unity. The developer community basically said, okay, well, that's it. We're never using Unity again. Unity backed down. I knew they would. They had to. And now the aftershocks. Ricciatiello is out.
Yeah,
it's complicated. I mean, you know, the hard part is for a lot of these companies, they did a lot of stuff to make sure they compete with each other. Whether it's Unreal, you know, Epic did its own thing, and Unity did those. And a lot of these have been kind of this free, but then eventually you're going to have to pay. And Unity took a lot of ground because of the model that it had. But even now, Unreal is you know, or Epic is trying to figure out how to restructure because so many people are using their software for free. Because if you're doing production tools in Epic, you actually don't need.
But it doesn't hurt them if you're using it for free. It doesn't cost them more money. They just want to.
They're not generating enough revenue.
They're not making more, but.
It costs them money in the sense that they have overhead and they're not able to cover it because there's not enough revenue coming in. You know, there is.
So it's not so. See, to me, the way to phrase it is not that more people are using it for free, but that fewer people are using it paid. Would be really
well, or just not enough. Like they've grown to a certain point. They were growing at a certain. If the growth doesn't make, you know, this is the problem that Epic is having as well. They had to lay off a big chunk. I mean, I think it's 900 people or something like that, in the not too distant past because they, you know, they're not making as much money with Fortnite. They probably wouldn't have that problem if they hadn't sued Apple. So they didn't get any return out of that. All they got is, you know, the problem for Epic now is they're not being shown on every keynote at Apple, which they were almost every keynote was showing Epic, Epic in some way, shape, or form until they sued Apple. And so suddenly they're now finding out they don't have they're not making as much money as they were before. And so I think that they're having to rethink their model. I think Unity, again, I think that their growth isn't, at some point, the growth doesn't make up for the fact that you're not charging enough for your product. And now it's hard, like as any first grader will tell you, you can't change the rules in the middle. so that's the real challenge they have. It's not that the what they're asking for is necessarily outrageous. It's just changing the rules in the middle of the game, and that's always going to be hard.
Yeah, I think they also proved to themselves that they rely on their developers a lot more than the developers rely on them. Like in terms of if they were to do anything that was sufficiently frisky as to cause an open revolt, they would have to shut that down really quickly.
It's not as fluid as I think the developers made it sound. I mean, it's not as easy just to move. I mean, a lot of developers said, we're just going to go somewhere else. Someone who's tried that in the past, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, like,
and
like
a lot
you,
of and, a lot of like, people like, opened
a
up
a lot of work,
opened up GitHub pages with their own engine, but that takes years. You can't.
I mean, Apple is partnering with Unity. Apple is the largest company in the world, and they're partnering with Unity instead of building their own you know, solution.
Tells you something.
Like, we just think about how complicated it must be if Apple is doing this instead of building it themselves.
Yeah. And I want Unity to succeed. I certainly don't want them to go bankrupt or anything like that. Yeah. In fact, many of the games I love dearly, like Valheim, are written in Unity. But I also don't want Valheim, which is a 20-person team, to go belly up because they can't afford to pay licenses for all these people who installed their game over the last 3 years.
Because the problem really is that those games didn't build into their business model that they'd be paying Unity. So it's not just that Unity is just suddenly doing something that might be reasonable, might not be what we can make that. But the problem is that all their business models, how they charge people and how much they charge and everything else is all. So everybody has to change the rules or they'll go under. So Valheim might have to say, well, we can survive, but now we're now going to have to all charge you this much a month.
Yeah, I mean, what they did is they put it out in beta for $20 at the beginning of the pandemic, and they haven't charged me a penny since. Obviously, I'm not paying my fair share for Unity. It's a good deal. Right. Epic had to fire a bunch of people. And it's funny because Epic made so much money on Fortnite. Tim Sweeney, their CEO, made $7 billion the year Fortnite was released. But they're now in tough straits and have fired, I think, 16%.
Well, and again,
is that because of Unreal Engine?
Well, it's definitely part of it. I mean, again, Epic was getting this pump from Apple every keynote. They had an Apple platform to go to. And I think part of the other issue is that when 87% of kids under 18 are using iPhones and you're not there, things start to tighten up, a little bit on your revenue. So I think that that's the real, I understand why Epic took Apple to court, because they want to build a platform and sell products. They want to sell into the metaverse, so to speak. They want to be able to make that, and taking 30% out for every sale is not going to make that viable. So, they have a vision for their marketplace, which is that's really where they want to go. So I get what they're doing. It's just that they had to do something, but biting the hand that was feeding them a lot might have not been the best outcome there.
Yeah, Epic cut 830 jobs.
Yeah. But don't you think that's a sign of really good corporate leadership, where there are certain, we'll not mention the name of the beast lest he appear, but there are CEOs who say, no, this isn't an argument. This isn't a discussion. This is a decision we've made. You people have to sort of have to live with it. And rather than turn this into an unnecessary showdown, they saw exactly how unpalatable this move was going to be, and they backed down from it. And actually losing the CEO it's probably one of the most, it seems to be in the forums that I've been looking at, one of the more popular decisions that the company has made in a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely I think it's a very Japanese approach to it. we took the wrong path. Somebody's going to,
the train that you're conducting was 45 minutes, 43 seconds late. I think you know what to do.
So Richard Tiello, who was actually a bit of a lightning rod at Unity, retired, effective immediately, scuttled away. They're replacing him with somebody else who, unlike Richard Tiello, has no experience in the gaming industry. Jim Whitehurst, you may know that name, former CEO of Red Hat. He then, of course, with the acquisition of Red Hat by IBM, became president of IBM. He retired or left IBM in 2021, so he's going to take over Unity. No gaming experience. He'd worked at Delta.
I think he's interim, right? He's just there.
Interim?
To,
yeah.
Yeah, I think he's just the interim CEO that's just there to keep the... I think that they felt that immediate action was required, but they don't have the right replacement yet. Because you bring some... It feels like you have to bring someone in from the outside. It doesn't sound like he might be the final pick, but it is something to kind of move the conversation quickly and try to quell the angry villagers.
Yeah, well, the villagers were real angry. They were going to have a town hall to talk about the changes, and then they got a bomb threat, and they think the bomb threat came from within the company, that somebody else at Unity had phoned it in. So that's not good.
HR is going to have its hands full after that one.
Oh, boy. Tim Cook.
Warning slip on the desk for sure.
Cashed in some stock. $41 million worth of stock. Guess Tim's going to buy himself a boat. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting when they sell, when people sell off. I mean, it's a very tiny number for Tim Cook. I don't think it's that big of a number for him. But I think that other CEOs, you know, have a regular schedule, and I think that that really makes a lot of sense. You know, is to not to create a lot of, you know, people talking about it. I think that, like, for instance, I think Mark Benioff gets a certain amount every week. Like, he just has, he sells off a certain amount of stock every week, and it never changes, and it's just constantly, you know, pulling that out. And I think that that makes a lot more sense than doing it in spurts.
I don't know. If I'm the SEC, I'm going to say, hey, you cashed in $750 million 2 years ago. What'd you do with that? Did you just spend it all? What'd you do with that? So I don't know what Tim's, I don't know what Tim's doing. This is second largest sale since that 2021 share of 750 million shares. He sold 241,000 shares yesterday and held back 270,000 shares for tax purposes. So it gives you some idea of how much money goes into the tax, goes to the tax man in all of this. $41.4 million after taxes. And so he had 750 million. He ran right through that. This is only going to get you a few months, Tim. I don't know.
Vegas. You just got to stay out of Vegas. That's all I'm saying.
Stay out of Vegas, Tim. Tim Cook is worth, according to Forbes, which according to Donald Trump, because Forbes took him off the list, is now a Chinese propaganda outlet. Tim Cook is worth $1.9 billion. So I guess, you know, this $41 million's pocket change, chump change.
Yeah, but you know what? That's not own your own space of company money, and that's got to really
you couldn't buy
him.
Twitter with that, right?
He's not, you got it. He's not an owner. He's only an employee.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, yeah. So.
I hear from certain sources that he needs the health, Apple has really great health coverage.
Excellent.
So, like, he's not going to retire because, again, the dental alone, it's like.
I saw a really interesting.
You want a decorative grill? Comped. $30 copay.
A really interesting article. Some reporter, I can't remember what outlet it was, had a, you know, you have the health savings account, and he got to the end of the year and he couldn't spend it. So he thought, well, I'm going to just try this executive health rundown that all the CEOs get, Tim Cook included, where they go to the Mayo Clinic or somewhere similar and get the full rundown. Something us poor schlubs don't get, because they're so important to the company. I mean, Tim Cook, I would say, is very worth a lot of money. But it wasn't hugely expensive. It was like $5,000 to do an MRI. He said it was amazing that they were so nice, and it was like a hotel, and it was really comfy. They get a very different experience of healthcare when they're CEOs, and they're that valuable.
Yeah.
I told Lisa I wanted to send her to the Mayo Clinic, so we'll see. We can't live without her. We're out of luck. What is this? Fake it till you fake it. One of you has put this one.
I put that in there. It's just a good piece by Nick here on Pixel Envy, his blog. He's a writer in Canada, and he's responding to a lot of the criticism of Google's announcement of their AI photo features.
Oh, a lot of people are saying, yeah, is it still photography?
What is a photo, right? And I think that from an Apple perspective, since that's what this podcast is, what there is a spectrum between sort of like, I think Apple is really dedicated, as we've been talking about with Sebastian's story, right? Like the art of photography and photos trying to reflect reality and having a certain philosophy of what photography is. And I think Google is on the other end of the spectrum, where Google is sort of like, look, computational photography, it's not really photography anymore. We can process it. We can do things with it. We're going to give that power to the user. And I think we can have debates philosophically about that. But what Nick here's point is, and I thought it was really great to make it, is, hey, everybody who's suddenly worried and clutching pearls about how now we can't believe what we see in photos, his point, and it's absolutely the perfect point to make at this juncture in history, which is, you've never been able to believe what you see in a photo from the very first photo taken, because a photo is all about, where is the camera? What's outside the frame? What happened before and after that moment? None of that is disclosed. There's no context to begin with. And of course, manipulation of photography began, believe it or not, before Adobe or before Photoshop, before the Knoll brothers designed Photoshop. People were still manipulating photos in dark rooms. They're also shooting lots of pictures and choosing the one that does the thing that they want. And like Nick goes through it. He's such a good writer, and it's a really fun blog post. But like, I think that what I took away from it is the overarching point, which is like, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Yes, Google is doing some things that seem a little extreme, and for my taste, maybe are like, maybe you're making it too easy. But the fact is, photography is always, has always been not something you should really trust unless you start to ask all those other questions about what happened outside of that one tiny moment in time in that tiny angle where that photo was taken.
Yeah, I can promise you that it did not look like this in Yosemite Valley when that thunderstorm hit. Without a little extra help from Ansel Adams dodging and burning. I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that was, you know, as a kid who was really into photography, reading Ansel Adams' Darkroom book absolutely made me feel great and got me energized, because I thought, wow, I can't take pictures as good as that. Oh, my God, they're so beautiful. But then seeing here's exactly how much work I had to put in to take the glass plate of this image and turn it into the print that you all know and love. I mean, this is an opportunity to teach people about media literacy, the basic media literacy that they should have already had, because there are books published in the 1890s on here is how to remove wrinkles from faces. Here's how to make waistlines look trimmer. There's I can't think of what it was, but there's a famous controversy that went on for decades. It only got solved kind of recently about a famous war photo. I think in a war zone in Belgium, where a famous picture of like this back country road stripped of all vegetation with just like cannonballs like riddling the cart paths. And the question, like, actually, there are two versions of this plate, one in which the cannonballs are in the road, one in which they are not. And just like examining the Zapruder film, people were examining, saying, okay, did the photographer put the cannonballs in the road, or did he take them off the road for composition? And it was only recently that they figured out that no, he definitely put them in there for his own. I mean, I think that this is all the features that Google introduced last week. They are really great, really strong, and really empowering, because they give ordinary people who are just futzing around with the built-in photo app with 5 or 10 seconds or 15 seconds of effort and no skill or training, the ability to do things that would normally cost you, like a year or two ago, a Photoshop subscription and at least a year or two of experience. I'm sure that I'm not the only one in this conversation who's like the unofficial Photoshopper of the family or the friend group. The number of times where like I find out that like my sister is in Disneyland because that got a picture. I got this beautiful picture of my nieces like in the middle of a sidewalk, but there are like some like, you know, people in the background. She would like to not be in the background and asked me, could you get rid of it? I want to print this out and have this on the sofa. I really don't want like this person who's got like mustard and gravy all over his t-shirt like to be the dominant thing. And there you go. You remove it. It takes you an hour or two and looks nice. Now it's something where they can just circle it, say, get rid of this, fill it in with more background, and boom, it's done. That's empowering. That's exactly what technology ideally is meant to do. Give power to people who do not have power, and sort of make it not so consolidated in the hands of just a few.
Well, and I think that it's also just so important for people not to believe what they see.
Exactly. Photos from 1855 during the Crimean War. Yeah. Right. And Errol Morris, the great documentarian, actually tracked it down, and there's a good podcast about it.
He actually traveled to the site to get pictures of it to figure out, okay, well, there are shadows that are moving, so maybe I can figure out by the movement of the sun. And was actually after working on this for years and years and years, it was a friend who just glanced at this who said, oh, well, don't you notice that like gravity like tends to make things roll down rather than up? So if the same rock is lower in this picture than in the first one, that means that whoever was like walking around there kicked over a rock, and he said, oh, that is conclusive. Thank you very much.
Well, and also, even, I mean, there's been discussions about Matthew Brady in posing things and not having it, you know,
I think part of the reason this is an issue now is it's so easy and anybody can do it.
Well, that's so important. It's so important that everybody can do it because then they understand that they shouldn't be looking at these things and thinking that's proof of something that we don't know what happened until we see it from a couple different angles, that we get it, you know, we see, you know, multiple reports on it, but saying that this photo or this audio sample. We've been doing a little bit of work with like, you know, rebuilding, you know, so there's a glitch in a record or there's something else. Like, can we rebuild that little section, with AI? And it works so well that it's frightening, you know, like that it just kind of, we forget that it's there, you know? And, mm-hmm. and so I think I think that it's really, really powerful. And I think people do need to know that it's easy. We've been doing it for a long time, not just photo manipulation, but, you know, you have a protest. I mean, I've worked on shows where we expected 300 people and 50 people showed up. And you know what that means? Put the camera on a riser. We're going to put the camera on a riser and we're going to point down and we're going to make sure that you don't see the empty room that we thought we were going to fill. You know, and that's just, and that is not a, I'm not manipulating the photo, but I am manipulating the situation, you know? And so, and those are things that are super common, that happen all the time. And so so it's really important to, for people to understand that they should look at everything through this filter of, I need more information to understand what happened.
Yeah. The only area in which it kind of worries me, and I'm not just talking about these phone features, but broadly, is when you're talking about photographs that are being entered into evidence and the ability, the potential for a defense lawyer to basically introduce an element of doubt. There's so many cases that hinge upon, hey, we've got security footage and here's where you see that the defendant was clearly approaching the car with a gun in their hand and doesn't look super, super clear, but yeah, it looks like they got a gun in their hand. But what if it's the photo has been taken in such a way that you can't get back whatever the original un-AI processed version of that image is? And you can say, yeah, it looks like a gun, but maybe the AI tried to figure out, I need to clarify what this person is holding. It's in the shape of a gun, so I'm going to not put a specific gun in their hand, but I'm going to sharpen it with the idea that it should be looking like this. There was a court case, was a couple years ago, where really, really reaching sort of attempt to discredit a photo where someone had the prosecutor had their iPad plugged into, you know, the overhead, the digital projector in the room, and just basically, you know, pinched and zoomed to basically zoom out to give you, it says focus on what it was. And so I think the defense had to say, oh, well, we don't know, like, as we all know, the iPad is, the Apple is actually adding more detail to there, so we don't know what those pixels actually are. And you have to step in and say, no, it does not add pixels. It simply makes these pixels kind of bigger. That's why they're
I think that most defendants deserve to call into question every piece of evidence. Yeah. And you have to see it. You have to triangulate it.
That's why I think there should be a chain of evidence for
Nick here points out in his this great Pixel MV post, Samsung has a feature that gives you perfect moon photos.
Yeah.
And they are adding pixels. They are
adding pixels, yeah. And I think that that'll keep on happening. And I think that the issue is that, you know, photos have, again, have never been, even eyewitnesses, you know, do not have a clear, oftentimes adrenaline and a lot of other things change what they actually think happened. And so that's why it's so important that we have a lot of different, corroborating evidence that ties into those things. And so that photo by itself shouldn't be the only thing that we look at. And it shouldn't even have a heavier weight than all the other things, because, you know, when a defendant is charged with something and the prosecution is coming down on them, it's generally not a fair fight. You know, so for 99% of the defendants out there, the prosecution has the home field advantage because they've got a lot more money. And so so we have to understand that it is important that we call into question, more important that we call into question all that evidence than to assume that it's correct.
Absolutely. There's also the CSI effect, where you have people on the jury box who have watched a lot of CSI, a lot of procedural crime shows. So if a prosecutor says, "Oh, well, we basically told our computer to zoom in and enhance," so we're using technology that wouldn't have been available 20 years ago, and that's how we see this clear picture of this. That's, and, you know, the people in the jury say, "Ooh, yes, zoom in and enhance. That's exactly, wow, that's how modern technology solved the case for us." It's like, no, basically the AI that has a bias for certain types of faces has an expectation of what it thinks a human face should look like. So if it enhanced it, it made it look like not necessarily what was there, but what the AI thinks, like what should be a Caucasian male face should be in that scene. So, yeah, again, it's all about media literacy.
I rewatched Minority Report over the weekend. That's another example of technology run amok. Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think there's an obvious answer, really, to this question, because I think we'd all agree that Samsung's beautiful moonshots are not, you know, fair game.
That feels like it jumps over. Like, it just feels like it's very unreal.
The fact
that they didn't talk about it, I think.
Yeah. Actually a quote from Nick's article that I think is probably worth repeating. Dr. Bob Carey, president of the U.S.-based National Press Photographers Association, said, quote, "If an image has been altered using technology, the photo consumer needs to know. Label it."
Yeah. That's also why I think that it's dangerous. The replacing the moon is a really great feature for the built-in photo editing app, for it to be part of the list of things to say, hey, I noticed that it looks like there's a moon in there. I'm sorry, but this isn't 2053. Our camera sensors cannot have the dark landscape underneath and also balance out the moon. Would you like me to create a moon for it? Because again, it's always the same moon. There's a little bit of a wobble from whatever time of the year is, but it's always the same side of the moon. That's something that can easily be done, and it will make it look a lot better than simply having a white dot in there. But that's the difference between this is something that you were offered a choice and you made a deliberate selection, as opposed to I took a picture, I sent the picture directly from the camera app to whatever, and this is the reality that I saw. You need to maintain that sort of portfolio of trust, and there's no need not to do that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what the answer is. You could put it in the EXIF information, as Nick points out, but then the EXIF can be modified.
Media literacy is part of the answer, is having these conversations and having, you know, Nick's blog post, and generally all of us recognizing the fact that it's never been true. It's just easier now to make it even less of a reflection of reality.
Right.
And being aware of that and not saying, I can't believe this. Right. I mean, media literacy is the answer to a lot of problems that we have in society, where you've got to like look at something and say, I don't know if this is real or not. It's like a big step, but it helps if you do that. And it's like, I'm not against photo editing. I have, there's a poster on the wall in my house framed, a picture of my kids at Trafalgar Square on one of the lions. And when I got home, the fact was I had a shot where my daughter looked great and a shot where my son looked great, and they weren't the same shot. And I ended up in Photoshop putting them together and using part of a third shot in order to cover something else that had changed between the two shots. And I don't think anybody can tell, and it's on my wall. And I know, like, it's also, I'm also sort of depicting, and that's the thing about the face replacement that Google is doing. It's depicting a moment in time, right? It really is, because every pose that's being made when you're taking a picture, that is already artificial because you're posing. And it's sort of like the whole purpose of it is to get a nice picture. Like, I'm okay with making that easier. In fact, at some point, what it's going to do is it's going to do a capture like of every frame possible during that moment, and then just kind of go through and assemble it for you.
But now you
have to do it like this.
I mean, what I do is I sit there and I go, okay, everybody smile. And I take 100.
Like, exactly.
Right. And I just take this time frame, and then I just go back and find all the ones that are there. And this is just doing that a lot faster.
No, that is the sort of thing that will sell a phone. I mean, because everybody has, just like we're talking before about being able to use Bluetooth to locate your wife, like in a football stadium. That is a very real practical thing that makes you happy that you bought this phone. The number of times you take pictures of four people in a group, your kids, and one of them can't got their finger out of their nose in one frame. The ability to simply say, okay, we'll just replace that. Don't contact your cousin who knows about Photoshop. Do it that way. The ability to, I want to be delicate about this, but there's times when, like, you're out with your family, and like there is someone who's not a member of the family. They're like maybe a friend of like one of your nephews or something, or someone that they just met and they've been hanging out with. And it's the only beautiful group photo you've ever had of like all your nieces together. And plus this one person that nobody even remembers who they were, the ability to simply let's lose this kid and shove this other kid to it looks like just these four people in the space. That's another one of those things where people like what used to be a real project for even someone who knows Photoshop is now, it'll suggest, here are we're outlining these specific separate people in this picture. What do you want to do with any one of them?
We no longer have to. We no longer have to fold the photo in the wedding album.
Yeah, oh God, I've been asked to take pictures like casually of weddings, like twice for friends, like where it was they almost have to sign a document saying that I promise them not even one photo from this, but I will like, and so every single day, even as a non-pro, I thought, okay, I think I'm going to pick a place where I'm going to get all the formal portraits taken. I'm going to put it on a tripod and I'm going to take one picture of just the background with nobody there so that if someone needs to go, I have a clean background for them. And that's the sort of power that is going to be available to everybody just on their phone.
We're really at a cliff here where it's not just photography, but everything is going to be suddenly untrustworthy, right? What is the answer to this? Just don't trust anything.
Just know that it's not. I mean, we should trust a lot less than we've been trusting, you know. And so I think it is. It's not that you don't trust anything, but you need to see a couple different. You should not trust anything on its, you know, on its face. Like I think that is, and that should have happened a long time ago. Maybe hundreds of years ago.
But it's worse and worse. And now with AI generating text, it's not just photographs.
I wouldn't say worse and worse. I would say more and more obvious.
That's interesting. It's always happened, but in the background, without.
Yeah, when we absolutely believed everything we saw because there were three. I mean, because there were three networks, and they all told us this is what we believed. In some, you could argue that was worse when it wasn't. If it wasn't, you know, totally accurate. You know, there's a lot of things that get. You know, whether it's being manipulated by the people that are handing the press that it's not that the press is trying to lie. It's just that. It has it's trying to publish information with incomplete data, you know, all the time. Like the press is always in a situation where it's being given data and it has to do the best it can. But at the same time, there's been a lot of things that we thought were so that just weren't, you know, and we go back and it's not a conspiracy theory. There's a lot of things that we just go, oh, well, yeah, absolutely. That was actually not exactly what happened. Yeah. Or a lot of things are withheld. So you don't have enough context to understand what that actually meant. So those are things that have, you know, been around since we started publishing anything, you know. And so the of how it's being spoken of and even just the lens that is listened through. So that has manipulated a lot more people at one time than what we're doing now. And so I think that what it does do is it's definitely building up micro distrust that is, I think, very healthy. You know, and again, I think that people, when I see stuff, and I've worked on a lot of cases where from the surface I went, oh, that person's guilty. And then as you start to dig into it, you're like, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, like,
that's
I don't know.
True.
You know, and so the thing is that when you see all the data, as someone who's worked on some pretty high profile cases, or my father has, you see all the data and you're like, oh, I don't think that this actually happened. And everyone is sure that it went the other direction. And so the thing
but
is.
But we live in a land of, in a time of hot takes where everybody has an instantaneous ill-informed opinion and you're flooded with them. And thank you to social media for making that, you know, weaponizing that. and so now we're surrounded by garbage.
But I think, but the next generation is not going to believe anything.
Yeah, but that's problematic as well, right?
Yeah. Well, they'll say you have to prove it to me, and you have to show it to me from a bunch of different angles. And I mean, where you find it.
So I'll give you an example, because this is a big problem right now on X, formerly known as Twitter. They are trying to get their trust and safety people to eliminate disinformation about the tragedy happening in Israel right now. But Elon Musk is still posting QAnon crap, and it's just a flood of disinformation. There's really no way, Alex, to go and find out what's true. I mean, it's not like you can go over there and say, I mean, you could, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at a lot of different sources. So usually, like if you're looking at, you know, you're not going to find truth on Twitter, right, or X or whatever.
Yeah, clearly that's out, right?
But what MSNBC and NPR and CNN and Fox News.
So you have some trusted sources.
No, I'm not even saying any one of them are trusted. It's kind of like a blockchain. It's when you look at all the different sources that don't agree on a day-to-day basis about almost anything, whatever they all say is probably more reliable. you know, whatever all of them say that, that are, you know, if you, if MSNBC and Fox say the same thing, like this happened, or, and if you include Al Jazeera and NPR and you, you start having four or five different sources and then you look at that and they're all saying the same thing, what they agree on is probably pretty valid. What they all disagree on is their opinion. Like, you know, like it's their take on this.
Right.
But, you know, so, you know, but they're all like, all of those folks are saying, this is what we know happened is some, you know, some people came out of Gaza and did something and Israel, you know, and Israel is doing something back. And the facts of those things, almost all the news organizations, regardless of whether they agree on that, what that means and why it happened and all those other things are all things that are more conjecture, depending on what lens they look through. And looking at it through that, you know, because I try to listen to as many different sources, not definitely ones that there are ones that I go, yeah, and there's other ones that I'm just grating my teeth listening to. But I feel like it's important to constantly be listening to both sides of every issue, because I also don't agree with any one of them all the time. so it's, but I think that it's important that you're constantly looking at these from different angles, you know, and I think that's the, and I think most people in the United States are not doing that.
I think the real risk in this is cognitive bias, and that you're going to end up favoring the thing that agrees with what you think. Because what it sounds like you're doing is taking weighted opinions and then amalgamating them getting magical answers out of it.
Well, what but they all agree on,
end
the
up, I think the real problem with this is you're going to end up with confirmation bias. You're gonna just say, well,
which
yeah,
you always would.
Like, yeah, I mean, we always have, I guess. It's just, yeah, I mean, there was some hope.
You
ask
10 people in the United States about whether we should have left Vietnam,
right?
You know, and what that meant.
No, that's right.
And whether we could have won, or you know, and that's an old, you know, that's, you know, like there's a lot of different opinions about that.
Yeah.
You know, and so and about all of these things.
One of the advantages, one of the reasons this is a traditional Soviet propaganda ploy to flood the zone is one of the consequences of this is people give up. And they just dial out, as opposed to trying to figure it out, right?
Yeah.
And that's good for the people who would like to pull the wool over your eyes, because the more people who aren't paying attention, the better it is.
Or you show you a bunch of stuff, and there's usually a lot of stuff. I mean, especially in a military action, there's just a lot of stuff that they're not talking about.
There's the fog of war, too, of course. Know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
anyway, our hearts go out to everybody in the area suffering from this. Absolutely. And there are a lot of tech companies, by the way, Israeli companies. There was an article that a significant percentage of these companies of their employees are going to war. And so expect some disruptions. We have an advertiser who's Israeli who said, you know, we're going to have to stop advertising for a little bit. And I said, yeah, I think you will. I think you should.
Yeah. I mean, our mutual friend Brent Bai was in Tel Aviv when it hit.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that. Oh,
no.
Is he okay?
He's okay. He sent me a cell phone thing. Like he went out to, oh, I hear some banging. He went out and the bangs got pretty close. So he ran back inside. And so, so he found his way out. You know, it was a little bit of tricky to find a little flight to get out of the country and then bigger flights to get home. But it's a pretty intense time right there.
Yeah. Our hearts go out to all those suffering. It's a very, very terrible thing.
Yeah.
I think we, one more story. I wanted to talk about Dan Morin's story. If you have a problem with iCloud, wait 12 hours, essentially. Could you summarize this, Jason Snell?
Yeah, well, Dan, basically, this is a great story of what it means. His point is about Apple being a little bit too much of a black box, and I think that's a pretty strong point here, is he relies on it for email and other stuff, and it just stopped working. And that's frustrating, right? You rely on it. It's your work day. And it started right at his work day beginning. He couldn't get access to his email. iCloud wasn't syncing. He goes through Apple support. And there's a moment in his story that's just amazing where the person he's talking to on the phone at Apple support gives a little laugh and says, oh, I see what's going on here. let me put you on hold. And then comes back and says, okay, I can't tell you why, but this will be solved in 12 hours from when it went down. It'll be back up in 12 hours exactly afterwards.
12 hours.
And sure enough, 12 hours later, right as Dan is done for the day, everything comes back up. And the question is like, why? One, like why? What is there something weird going on there? Is there a court order? Are they going through the server? Did the server catch on fire? Why is it 12 hours exactly from when it went down? Is it scheduled maintenance? Is it, again, something legal? And the you know, right, like running services and stuff is hard and there's downtime. And even if you're like down only 0.1% of the time, that's many, many hours a year that you're down. And that's just how it is, right? Right. If you're down 1%, you're down 36 hours a year, right? Like, or 3 days, you're down 3 days, right? Yeah. Let me do that math. Like little numbers that are actually just brutal if you're running a service. So I get it. But Apple adds the extra thing of they just don't want to ever communicate with you anything, right? Like when I have other things going on with other services I pay for in the cloud, I get communicated with. Linode will say, we have to reboot your server, or we're going to move your server to new hardware. It'll be down for 2 hours probably-ish at 2 a.m. on this day in 3 weeks, right? And I know that mysterious things happen all of a sudden, but again, you could have a thing that says, oh, current status of your server, in particular on iCloud, it's broken or it's down or we had to take it offline. It will estimated return is this, right? Even the cable company does that. But Apple just doesn't have it in them. And it's a problem when you're doing services because this is a case where Dan relies on it to do his job and it's just not there. And I mean, it's easy for people out there who are watching this to be like, well, that's your lesson. Don't use iCloud. It's like, yes, but iCloud is a product that is offered by a very large company and integrates it with all their systems in a way to make you want to use it. And we can all blame the victim here. But how about this, which is why doesn't Apple communicate stuff like this to its customers? It's a case where they've like taken their secrecy about like product releases. And also I think their pride in creating things that aren't too complicated. It just works and all of that. And then allowing that to sort of like be a little rug that they can sweep all the other dirty stuff under when they shouldn't. Disclosure should be the order of the day for stuff like this.
And
the fact that that customer service person laughs and goes, oh, I see what's going on here, but will not disclose it.
Well,
it's bananas.
There are a number of theories, you know, 12-hour maintenance windows, so forth. But I like the theory that it's a national security letter, and that the law enforcement has said you must freeze the server until we do our forensic examination, and you can't tell anybody.
Number of 1,000 users on it.
Yeah, and you can't. And by the way, as often is the case with an SL, you can't tell anybody. So you know what's going on. Because they don't want the perpetrator to know that this is going on. So it may not be Apple's fault. Who knows? We don't know. I agree with you. Disclosure is everything when it comes to the cloud, as is making sure you have a local copy and you can do as much of your work as possible without access to the cloud. You know, our power went out for 3 hours. Access to the internet is also very important. You can't guarantee that the PG&E, our local power company, is going to tell you when it's coming back accurately. And it's a lot harder to get anything done without the internet. I can tell you right now.
Yeah, I've had one of those like Jackery, one of those really, really big like shoebox size battery banks, like kind of on my wish list for a while now, because the number of times where like all I need, why do we have to lose power like 20 minutes before I have to do a show? All I need is to be able to run a small setup for 90 minutes, and I will have 6 days to solve this problem. But right now, I need a box full of electricity that won't run out for 90 minutes.
We were actually fortunate. So the last week, the power went out in the studio, and there's no way we can have a big enough battery to stay on the air. So everything shut down. Aunt Pruitt was the last man out, and he did a little video of himself tiptoeing out in the pitch black. A couple of days later, we didn't have an outage here. We had an outage at our house a couple of miles away, but we have Tesla power walls. And so there was a blip, and then we continued on and survived, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And the internet survived because I guess it didn't go down. And so it was a business as usual. Yeah. We can continue to watch Band of Brothers, which we are, I might add, rewatching, because get ready, Apple TV in January is going to give you the third entry into the Band of Brothers saga.
Did you hear that I don't think I'd put it in the doc, but the director's cut of Napoleon is going directly to Apple TV. And so, like, the director was saying about how this is, like, the perfect situation where it's usually sweating bullets for him. Like, again, as a director of, like, Alien, as the director of, like, all these really great epic movies, like, to have to, like, cut down a director's cut to make sure that it'll actually fit into a release slot. That, yes, it's going to be released direct to theaters exclusively, but shortly after that, you will get, like, it currently stands at 4 hours and 20 minutes, I think, Ridley Scott's version of
I want to see that. That's not out yet, is it? It's...
No, I don't think it's released till November. I think, November. Yeah. But yeah, this is the reason.
This is what Apple should do. This is brilliant.
It's not only prestige, but it's epic prestige. This is like classic, like 1960s, 1970s. Crazy directors wanting to make a movie as big as they can possibly make it on a subject that cannot possibly be contained by anything more than 20 hours worth of footage.
So the theatrical version is 2 hours and 38 minutes. Fine. Release that. Get as much movie tickets and sell some popcorn and then all that. But for the real buffs, put the 4+ hour cut on streaming, because we can always pause it and go to the bathroom and things like that. I think that's fantastic. Apple hasn't said, but presumably they'll do both the theatrical cut and the director's cut. In fact, I'd love to see, when you buy stuff on iTunes now, they often have DVD extras, including commentaries. And I'm really glad those are surviving, because I think
anything if I don't.
Yeah, I look for
I don't
that.
Like that. The reason I'm like, the reason I buy, and I can find it on a free service. The reason I own hundreds of movies on iTunes or whatever they call it, TV, is because I can go through all those extras. You know,
Apple's budget for first run flicks, according to 9to5Mac, is $1 billion a year, which isn't going to go that far. The new Exorcist sequel cost $400 million. So you'll get two Exorcist sequels and maybe a low budget thrown in.
I think Apple is starting to prove, I think, that quantity over quality and quality over quantity.
Yes.
And you know, with the changes in a lot of the contracts and everything else, the rumor is that a lot of the services are going to take more of Apple's route, which is really spending a lot more money on a lot less content, because it's just of the way that everything's structured. So it's going to, I think that you'll probably see a lot more of that from all the services.
That's a good way to solve the conundrum for streaming services, which is, how do we keep people paying for subscriptions? I think if you offer something of real value, they're going to pay for it.
Yeah, and you spread it out. I mean, that's what Disney does pretty well, which is that we're just going to keep on rolling things out to you at a certain rate. And I think that you'll see probably more windowing, which Max is doing more of, where they're just taking stuff out, rotation as well. So those will, because they're going to have to manage it a lot tighter now than they had before.
Yeah. There also seems to be the swing away to, well, you know what, let's not just dump all the episodes at once and have people binge it. Let's give people a reason to come back and open up that app at least once a week. And it's good for episodic storytelling. It's also probably good for the bottom line. And
I can't watch it anymore. Like, I can't.
Really?
I can't watch weekly. My daughter's watching Gilmore Girls, and we were talking about the fact that she's like just plodding through it, and one after another. And I was like, yeah, they used to do this once a week. She's like, once a week? She watches one a day. And she's like, once a week? How can you keep track of what's going on in once a week?
I agree. I'm with her. My memory only extends about 7 hours. Sorry, I need to watch it. At least there's
some air between the episodes. Okay. Like I was watching this week's Bob's Burgers yesterday, and my God, they're in season 14, and they just made one of the best episodes of television I've seen in a long time. They're taking chances. They're doing things that are extremely hard. It hits hard emotionally, even though it's a comedy. Like, they find, we have an idea for a story that requires a major pivot in how we tell stories and how we direct this show.
Do I have to watch all 13 years of Bob's Burgers to understand the importance and value of this episode?
No, not at all. Good. As a matter of fact, it might even help because the main character, the main cast, like the Belcher family who run this burger restaurant that's struggling but doing but basically surviving in the seaside tourist town, they decided to we're going to take a minor character and make them the star of the show and tell a really interesting. And again, I was like, I'm fine. No, I'm just. I just need to change the air.
It's like episode 3 of Last of Us, which really didn't fit in with the rest of the thing. But it's obviously the director, the writers had some great thing they wanted to express.
Yeah.
And, put it there.
But what I'm getting at is that if you had asked last week was another really nice, well-earned, challenging episode, but more of a line, more along the lines of a typical, like, funny episode with lots of funny bits in it. If you had, with a week's worth of air between last night's episode and this week's episode hit so much harder and was so much more of a beautiful experience. Whereas if I were just watching all of them, like, in one afternoon with no time to, like, process and ruminate, it would have seemed like a piece of disposable, like, conveyor belt.
Yeah, I
no
confess.
Package of Twinkies off the
I'm a binger.
Line.
I am. If I can binge, sometimes I'll even put off a series until it's fully dropped to watch it all. But then I feel like I ate a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts at one sitting and I kind of regret it. So maybe it's not the best. When Lisa and I look up and we say, we've been watching this show for 5 hours. That's when we know maybe it wasn't the best. Final story before we take our break and get your picks. We now know what was wrong in France. you remember that the French authorities said you cannot sell the iPhone 12, it will kill our people.
It's a radioactive nightmare.
Terrible thing. Oh. And Apple said, well, okay, we're going to fix it. We're going to fix this here. And the French said, you better or you cannot sell it. So Apple has now in iOS 17.1, which will be the fix, put this summary out. iOS 17.1 includes an update for iPhone 12 for users in France. To accommodate this specific test protocol that requires reduced power when off body on a static surface. So it was a very particular situation. iPhone 12 will no longer increase the allowed power when the off body state is detected, such as when it's sitting on a table. As such, in coverage areas where cellular signal is low, ain't gonna work as well. But you probably won't notice it. So I guess they're turning up the antenna. If it's not in your pocket, if it's off, because it's, presumably to protect you. And the French said, well, we can see it. It's still radiating into my foie gras. So
no, basically it's that they had a test system for the safety of the phone without taking into consideration that the iPhone can detect when it's not actually close enough to somebody's body to do any damage, where they can just say, let's go YOLO with a radio signal. However, it's on a test stand that's designed to measure how much radiation is coming off of it. So whereas it started off with oh my God, this is pumping out there are people who are like, basically their left ear is green and Hulk-ish because of all the radiation coming off of the iPhone 12. Yeah. No, because of here is a test protocol that Apple was not sufficiently hip to be able to make sure that they can pass this protocol.
I love that name. So they took the Let's Go YOLO feature out of the iPhone 12, but presumably that's in all subsequent iPhones. So 17.1 will, I assume, fix this. And no more Let's Go YOLO. Thank you for that.
I'm surprised it took them by surprise, because it's like if there's anything that an iPhone has to test, they have to pass in any regionality, they know what it is and they want to make sure that they pass it. It's amazing. And also realize that the iPhone 12 has been out for quite a while now. So and the French regulators were just now getting around to saying that, oh, there's a health hazard, we think, defined by this phone. If this were like an AliExpress phone that actually was causing like health issues, I would like want them to catch that in less than 2 years.
That's not bad. That's not a bad thing. But maybe a little sooner next time, French guys.
Yeah.
They were busy eating some brie, drinking some wine, enjoying their life. Besides, it was August.
Love your pastry.
Love the pastry, guys.
No notes. Right.
Little break, and then your picks of the week. As we continue with Mac Break Weekly, our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hey, you know what? A tip of the hat. Raise the roof. A shout out to all those people who in HR who have to hire employees. whether it's somebody like Lisa in a small business going to job fairs, HR directors vetting hundreds of applications. That is a tough job, and it's a very important job because every business rises or falls based on its people. So what if I were to tell you there's something that can make you, you heroes of the hiring revolution, your whole hiring process faster and easier? Well, there is. It's ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. You will love ZipRecruiter. It's what we use when we need to hire for a number of reasons. Of course, once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it goes out to over 100 job sites. So you're casting the widest possible net. ZipRecruiter is a lifesaver, though, because all of those applications don't go into your email box. They don't go into your phone voicemail. They go into the ZipRecruiter interface where you could do some really useful things. They reformat all the resumes, so it's easy to scan them. You can actually write screening questions, true, false, multiple choice, even essay questions, to help you eliminate people who just don't have the qualifications you need. And then there's this. ZipRecruiter's powerful technology. They have a million plus resumes, current resumes on file, scans through those resumes, and looks for people whose skills and experience match your opening. They don't then tell those people. They tell you. They say, hey, we've got 20 people here who seem to fit your job listing. What do you think? You get to look at them and say, well, that guy, oh, yeah, she's great. Okay, how about these three? We're going to invite them to apply. I'll tell you what happens when you invite somebody to apply. You jump right to the top of the list. Because, I mean, let's face it, we are competing for the best employees. It's a tough situation out there for employers. Wouldn't you like those top employees to come back and say, yeah, I want this job? They asked me. They invited me. They'll apply sooner. They'll stick through the whole process and much more likely to be the employee that you hire. ZipRecruiter has helped make hiring faster and easier for businesses of all sizes. It's all we use. We love it. We will find a good candidate usually within just a couple of hours, which is important when you're down a person. 3.8 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. You should too. So to you hiring heroes, I say, let ZipRecruiter make your job easier. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to our special address, ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak, and make sure you use that so we get credit. And try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We thank them so much for doing such a good job for us. They'll do a good job for you, too. Try it free. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. Jason Snell.
Leo Laporte.
Pick of the week.
Hello.
Hello, sir.
Pick of the week.
Hello, sir.
Hello, sir. Pacoima. Hello. You're on.
Hello, Pacoima.
Do you know the count or the amount?
Lemon Grove. You're coming in clear, Lemon Grove. Bartender 5 is out. And Bartender an essential
yes.
Mac utility.
Yes.
New version number 5. $16. Cheap. If you're already using it, $8 upgrade fee. Cheap. I am a little bit of a minimalist. It turns out I don't like a lot of clutter, unnecessary clutter on my Mac, including in my menu bar.
And if you're a person with a notch, this is
indeed
a must because stuff hides behind the notch.
Exactly. So what this does is it lets you organize the items in your menu bar up in the upper right-hand corner, all those little icons, and it does things like hide them until you move your mouse into the menu bar. You can do groups in this version, in version 5. There's actually a scripting interface, so you can actually have it like run a test and say, like, if this is true, show this item. Otherwise, keep it hidden. So it's like a lot of really advanced features. You can change the look of the menu bar, too, to make it look like really weird and creepy, and I don't like it, but like little lozenges or little floating bars and stuff instead of the traditional Mac menu bar. But like, I have like 5, 6, 7 items that are just hidden, like Dropbox, for example. Like if I want to use, I don't need to see the Dropbox icon all the time in my menu bar. If I want to look at the Dropbox menu, I will move my mouse up and it reveals all of the hidden icons, and then I can click on the Dropbox menu. Same for a whole bunch of other menu bar items that are just, I don't need to see them unless I choose to go up there and see them. I don't need to have them hovering in my peripheral vision all this time. So it's a really simple utility that does all of that. A bunch of tweaky settings if you care. It's such a good well-built Mac utility, continuing to be updated, continue to be supported, new features added all the time. It's so good. It's a must-have for me. Every time I sit down in a Mac and I see like 15 icons splayed all the way out into the notch, no. Bartender. Ugh. Bartender 5. Ugh.
Hate
MacBartender.com.
Yes.
MacBartender.com.
Recommended. Highly.
So good.
Yes. And coming soon, menu bar widgets, which will be very interesting to see how those work.
Like I said, there's a lot going on in that developer's brain about what to do up in the menu bar. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what that's all about. Andy Iannocco, pick of the week.
Really exciting one this week. After 4 years, we have a new version of the Raspberry Pi single board computer. I have pre-release hardware, or the first one's off the line. It starts pre-orders at the end of this month, and oh my God, it is a huge, huge upgrade over the previous one, over the Raspberry Pi 4, where the 4 was a hell of a lot of fun because it could do pretty much anything you wanted it to do. Like if you want to slap it inside a case, plug in a screen, keyboard, whatever, and use it as like a simple Linux box, it will work just fine. As well as, hey, I want to run it as a media server. Hey, I want to run it as an ad blocker on my network. I want to run it as the core of a robot, run AI models, vision models on it, whatever you want to do with it. This is such a boost in performance that whereas before I would use it as a desktop sort of in a pinch or just to show that I can do it, now it is a legit desktop. Like it's fast enough and has enough I/O on it that I've had it plugged into like one of the HDMI ports on my desk, like next to the my Mac Mini, and it was running fast enough and solid enough that it did that thing where I forgot that I was testing something and I just got into an afternoon of work with it. because before there, you would see a sort of kind of a lag, particularly if you're doing like video, there's limits to what it could do. Now it really is so fast that it can handle pretty much anything. They also super upgraded the IO. Now it has a PCI Express. So if you want to use, instead of an SD card, you want to use like an M2 SSD. It doesn't have an M2 slot on it, but now like you put a hat on it with the IO pins, and now basically it has PCIe, so it can run like a regular M2 SSD, like a 2 terabyte SSD at the speed that you would expect a desktop to go at. Not super, super, super duper fast, but again, the idea of I want to run this as a media server, or I want to basically put together a $100 desktop box that I can use, I can keep in the living room with one of my old screens and old keyboards. It's also super, super cool because you remember a couple of weeks ago I talked about this really cool app for my iPad called Orion by Lux, the same people who do that camera app that we've been talking about earlier
Haylight.
Today.
Yes.
Haylight. I don't know why it's not in my mind, but yeah, where with this free app, you can plug in like a $15 HDMI adapter, HDMI to USB, excuse me, USB 3. Sorry. A $15 HDMI adapter to your iPad and turn it into
too many Krispy Kremes, and that's what's going on.
Well, the problem is that like I've switched to clear alcohol instead
of
the whiskey.
Yeah,
I'm kind of off my game. But the idea is that like they don't have like you can't get I don't have a case for it yet because it's a different like design. They have to put a different case in it. But I can easily it runs off of a standard power connector, so I can basically put this little deck of cards thing in my bag along with an HDMI dongle. And if I run into a situation where one of those many situations with as an iPad user where, oh, if I had a real PC with a real file system and a real operating system, I could solve this problem in like 20 seconds, but I don't. So I'm in hell with this like little board, like just in my bag. Hey, I can now use my, I can just simply plug into my, my iPad as simply an HDMI monitor. And with my keyboard, my mouse, now I have a real desktop PC, even though I didn't really intend to do so. It's the top of the line one. If you want a cheap Raspberry Pi, you can still get the previous models for the usual cheap rates of like anywhere from $10 to like $30 or $40. This is now the top of the line one with 4 gigs of operational RAM. It's $60. With 8 gigs, it is $80. That's still not a lot of money for a machine you can have a lot of fun with. I mean, just to close out. I mean, I do have some vintage Macs. Yes, I do enjoy them, but the reason why I just can't get any interest in actually getting like my Mac Classic up and running is because by the time I recap the board, by the time like I fix like any damage done to the board with like battery leakage, by the time like I get the monitor screen going, by the time like I make sure I have the proper mouse and keyboard, it's like, but I can just run emulation on this and it will be just, it'll run all the same software in color. This will support two 4K monitors simultaneously. That's how powerful it is. So I'm like, why wouldn't I just like tear out all the guts of this Mac Classic like a Halloween pumpkin, mount in a brand new like HD display and just have this empty shell of empty air that just has this little board and that little screen in it. It's like, that would be a much more, if all I want to do is like run apps and run OS 9 or whatever, it's a much, much better situation. But that's what I'm getting at. It's a fun board to have around just to say whatever I want to do with a single board computer, I can explore and have fun with it. Like, again, that's why I'm just not terribly interested in vintage computing, because every itch that I might have had that would be scratched by having like an Apple IIe set up for, oh, wow, I can write an assembler. Wow, I have complete control over everything. This is like complete control over everything, and it's completely modern setup too. So it starts shipping at the end of the month. I don't think they started taking orders yet, but go to raspberrypi.org to read more about it and find places where you can buy it. They might sell out really, really quickly. They've been really constrained on merchandise for the past couple of years since the COVID limitations. But so this might be your first opportunity to easily place an order for a Raspberry Pi and actually get it like in 3 or 4 days.
Very nice. Very excited about this. Alex Lindsay, pick of the week.
So, as you know, I cook a lot of things, and my whole family now has kind of gotten into cooking most of the meals that we have, and most of them are pretty much from scratch. And so we're constantly keeping track of recipes, and I was complaining about it, and a friend of mine was like, you got to check out Paprika 3. Paprika 3 is an app that runs on your, I'm using it on my iPhone. I guess you can use, I haven't used it on anything else.
I use it everywhere. I love Paprika. Yeah.
So, here's the killer.
I'm not talking the spice. I'm talking the app.
Paprika's pretty good. But the crazy thing here is when you go into browser and you have like almost every website that you would go to, Epicurious and BBC Food and Bon Appetit and everything else, and you find, then you go in, okay, I'm going to go to Epicurious and I'm going to find something on, let's say, pancakes. And I'm going to go to that. And so I find the pancakes that I want. We'll just say the Lazy Days pancakes. And the crazy thing is then you just say, I'd like to download that. And what it does is it pulls all the information that you wanted out of it. So it separates.
Because lately, this has been a terrible thing, but recipe sites have page after page of prose.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom of it, the recipe, and you've got to go all the way.
And they have all these, and the reason they put all that prose in is because they want all those ads. They have all these ads, and it just becomes, I get the business model, but it's really painful to use when you're actually trying to make something. So what it does is it extracts all that.
Here's the recipe at the bottom. So, yeah. So this is so cool. Go ahead. Describe it. I'm on an Epicurious Italian rainbow cookies. So
then you just go download at the bottom.
Press the download button.
And it just pulls it in.
And it's got a recipe. Oh, wait a minute. It didn't work on this one.
Oh, it didn't?
Because I think there was no recipe in it. Thank you, Epicurious.
Yeah, that's how you get that.
Yeah. But, holy cow.
It extracts it. And the big thing is that you can save it. And then once now you have this little list, but you can categorize it. These are my dinners. These are the ones that I like. These are the, I don't know, the ones that you make with
eggplant. Here's a good one.
Latkes. Those types of things.
Latkes. That's what we want to make. Yum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I have this.
That's a different latke. That's good though. I liked it. I got it. And so it puts in the recipe, but it puts in pictures.
It can once you save it.
Yeah.
Where's the save?
Let me save it. Yeah.
And then go open
now
it up.
Go to my recipes. So that was in a browser, and I'll do the most recent recipes so that we can.
Yeah.
Well, I can do it with anything. Let's do it with this. All right.
But then you have that scale and convert. So you go in there and you go, oh, right at the very top, right at the very top of the ingredients, right under ingredients, but above the words.
Yeah.
Like you'll see it. It's blue.
Yeah.
Hit that.
Scale and convert.
Right there.
And I can say.
Now. I can say this is a scale of one, but I have a lot more people coming, so I can make it two. I can change it to metric. I can do, you know, like I tend to cook in metric, so because I use scales for everything. Right.
Let's make chicken soup for 100.
Okay. Yeah, or you know, so many. And then make it metric, and then you'll be like, you know, 80 liters of chicken.
I need 100 whole chickens.
There you go. Exactly.
200 celery stalks.
So, but the thing is that you can categorize it. There's so much here.
Oh, I love this.
And it is. Yeah. It is.
And it syncs, which is really important to me, from your iPhone to your Mac, yeah, to your Windows PC, to your Android device. Hmm. So your recipes are everywhere.
And you can find them really quickly. You can add notes to them. It's easy to change. You're not trying to figure out where was that on Epicurious or where was that somewhere else. You now have it. You know, it's in there. And it's kind of, every time I open it, I find some new little thing that you're like, oh, this works really well.
So, grocery lists, meal planning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it work with the share sheets? Because I use Recipe Keeper it's nice because I'll be on Reddit or someplace and I'll come across a recipe and I just simply share it to the app and suddenly it is like inside my recipe book. I don't use the built-in browser.
I have to admit I don't know. I think I would cut and paste it in there. I have to admit that I just open it now.
The
browser inside the app. I haven't tried to use it somewhere. I don't know if it has an external input version of it, but it. And then it also has, you know, for instance, the other thing is you can say, I want to put this in my grocery list. And so you can take all the different meals that you're going to make. So you could decide, this is what I'm kind of working towards. I haven't figured this out all yet, but you basically say, these are all the things I'm going to eat next week. And these are the things that I need. And you can even add everything you have in your pantry. I'm not going to go that far, but you could. And then you say, these are all the things I'm going to eat. Put these all into my, you know, I can go through each one and say, I don't have this, I need this or whatever, but I'm thinking about it per recipe. It will then build a shopping list that has all of those things and it groups them based. The biggest thing, the problem I have is I do them as I think of them. I don't categorize them as the vegetables or the spices, but it does. So now I go and I can go on Sunday morning and which is the best time to get bread at Whole Foods, in case you're wondering. And so you can go to Sunday morning to Whole Foods and I can go and I can just go through all of it and go to each section and get everything that I need for next week's, you know, cooking. All, you know, and I didn't forget anything unless I, you know, but it's all categorized and it's just, you know, I feel like as I have to admit that the inflation has really, the place I notice it the most is when I go to restaurants.
It's so expensive to eat out now.
You know, and
it's outrageous.
And so I have to admit, between that and the fact that I really have been trying to eat much more healthy, we've just gotten to this thing where almost everything we have comes from the farmer's market now. And we bring it back and we have a CSA with, and so we bring stuff back and we go, and now we have to figure out what to do with this, with eggplant. which we went through a lot of last night, which is good.
Yep.
Anyway, but the point is the hardest part was trying to, you know, tag all of these websites and all these locations. And this allows you to just bring it all the things you have normal regularly, or even things you want to experiment with. It's all just gets pulled into one place.
Yeah. To answer your question, Andy, on iOS anyway, it is not in the share sheets, unfortunately. So you'd have to copy. That's a nice feature.
Yep. Yeah. I'm sure they can add that really easily because that's such a game changer.
It doesn't seem like you can save it. You can share with other people either. Haven't figured that out either. Where you can.
Oh, you can, but you have to share it in a format. And there's a couple of like the MasterChef format. You can share it to other people. I do that all the time. Everybody, all three of you now have had your favorite recipe app. So I'm going to get them all in here. So you say Paprika. I'm with you on that, Alex. That's the one I use. Andy, you said, what do you use?
Recipe Keeper.
Which sounds
like a fraudulent app, but is actually like a big
I think
thing.
That's been around for a long time. I used to use MasterChef, and that actually was like so successful that it made a standard for recipe formats.
Copyright Tudor Span Limited.
Tudor Span Limited. RecipeKeeperOnline.com. And I know, Jason Snell, you have one that you've recommended. What's your...
Mela.
Mela, the one that is eggplant.
M-E-L-A.
In Spanish or something.
Silvio Rizzi from Italy.
Yeah. So there's... You know what? if obviously all three of you are cooks. Mela is at mela.recipes. I think you probably should try all three of these and pick the one you like.
Yeah. I just realized I was in a super rut for weekend, like weekday cooking. Like I kick out the jams for the weekend, but on the weekdays, like, okay, let's put a pork cutlet in the sous vide and like heat up some rice or whatever. But yeah, the whatever app you use, it really is kind of a game changer, because the times when I'm shopping and I suddenly remember, oh, that's right, I saw that really cool like recipe for, they called it apple cider donut bread. Like, what do I need to get for that? And because it's right there on your phone already, as opposed to a bookmark somewhere in your browser, you tend to actually leap on that. And when you go to the next level and you start doing things like, yes, definitely, I want to slot this in for Tuesday night, or I'm going to slot this in for Thursday night, and like Alex says, it will just simply tell you, here's what you need to buy and why you need to buy it. It's just amazing.
It's funny, we're all cooks, aren't we? I guess that's a good thing. You should
be. We all eat food.
Yeah, everybody eats.
Commonality in most mammals.
The things I'm really working on with my kids is making sure they know how to cook. Because I didn't really cook much until I was probably 30. I knew how to cook ramen.
But kids need to cook.
It's such a basic skill. Yeah. I think that in all of our, No Child Left Behind and all the things that we did with our school, we took out all the home ec and all the things that, and the shop class and all the things that actually made life livable.
Art, music.
And so that we could learn things that we'll forget. I just think that it's such a core skill that I wish I had gotten into much earlier.
And yeah, I agree.
If you're listening to this, there's nothing better than learning how to cook and just being able to be self-sufficient with basic stuff, not feeling like you have to buy.
Cooking attracts nerds because it's like chemistry. It's like coding.
I think that Alton Brown is what got me into it.
Oh yeah. Yep. He's fantastic.
Just watching Alton Brown.
And nerd.
It's just nerdy. And he was a nerd that went to learn cooking so that he could make a nerdy TV show about it. So that's the perfect solution. And if you don't watch Alton Brown, then you should. If you're listening to the show, you should watch out. You should go back and look.
Good Eats. Check it out.
Well, by the way, I just installed Melon. I noticed it somehow automatically imported all of my paprika recipes. So a little victory for Mela there. It's not cross-platform, but boy, that's good. Nice job. How did it know? How did it find them all? That's impressive.
I imagine that saving them in a folder in your iCloud or on your phone.
Yeah, must be the paprika
folder. You knew
where to look. And this is the problem in general is you know, if you pick a... That's why I was so mad that MasterChef disappeared, because I had so many recipes in there, right? And so that's a nice feature.
It's weird with what gets you into it. The show on the Food Network, Chopped, actually got me perked me up, because just watching how people cook in a non-fussy presentational way, just like, oh, that's why, like, when I make green beans, like, there's always way too much dressing or way too little. It doesn't. They actually get a little metal bowl and they actually toss it in the bowl before they take it out of the bowl and put it on. It sounds stupid, but it's like I've seen my mother and my grandmother do,
right?
Which means that if they did it wrong, if they did it brilliantly, that's how I'm doing it for life. If they did it wrong, I'm going to be keeping doing it wrong until the rest of my life. So that's all kids should learn how to cook.
Well, we all agree on one thing anyway. So thank you very much, all three of you, for a wonderful show. Jason Snell is at sixcolors.com. We've referred to it quite a few times on this show, so I think you probably should go visit. And, of course, all of his podcasts are at sixcolors.com/Jason. Is there one in particular you think people should be checking out?
Oh, I don't know. Robot or Not is a podcast that I
love
do. It's ridiculous.
I love that idea.
Me and John Syracuse, and we just debate like what things are. Or really, John sort of tells you what the right answer is, and you can take that as you may. But it's just, we did the first 100 episodes just about if something was a robot or not. And then we've since spread out to broader philosophy things. The most recent episode is about nachos, where John, being from Long Island and living in Massachusetts, there was a question about what nachos are. And I was like, wait a second, John, I got this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lifelong California.
I don't know what they do in Southie for nachos, but I don't think it's the same in California. I don't know.
It turns out, though, that in England, chips and cheese means something entirely different. So,
oh,
It's like French fries with cheese on it.
Oh, okay. I thought it was dirty. Oh. I thought it was a Urban Dictionary entry. Ah, oh, no, you want to do chips and cheese, eh?
It's just French fries with cheese on them. Why would you do that?
Well, anyway. I found out when I went to Wisconsin that cheese curds are just cheese.
Yeah.
So, eye-opener for me. Andy and Akko, when are you going to be on GBH next?
I'll be at the Boston Public Library next Friday at 12:30. So you can come on in, go to the cafe, buy yourself a coffee or a beverage or a sandwich, and watch what's going to be a really cool 2-hour show of me being like maybe 20 to 30 minutes of it. Or go to WGBHnews.org to stream it live or later. Or go to the WGBH News channel and on YouTube to actually watch the video later.
Thank you so much. Great to have you. Alex Lindsay, Office Hours is the place to go to find out what's going on in the world of production and graphics and cooking and a lot of other things. What's up on Office Hours this week?
Well, you know, we're trying a little 1-2 punch here with interviews, and so we're going to see how this goes. So Michael Krasny had Ian McKaig, who's an old friend of mine from Lucasfilm, one of the character designers for Star Wars, on last Friday, just released today. So we just dropped it on graymatter.show. And then we're having Ian on Office Hours on Monday.
Oh, nice.
So you get to kind of listen to the interview and then go and then ask questions yourself. So we're kind of doing this. So, but it's people kept on texting me like, this is an incredible interview, like, you know, with Ian. And so Ian McKaig is not just a great artist, but just the way he approaches life is pretty interesting. He'll say things to the side that you're just like kind of mind blowing.
Wait a minute. You interviewed Geraldo?
Geraldo Rivera. Yeah.
That must have been interesting.
Here's a funny thing.
Yeah.
I know you say it's interesting. It is the most multi-dimensional version of Geraldo that I've ever seen.
Well, like,
it is the best interview of Geraldo that has ever.
Krasny would be able to bring out the best, I think. Yeah.
He brought out an entirely, a much more nuanced version of Geraldo Rivera.
Is he friends with Geraldo? Is that?
No, I don't know. His Michael's Rolodex is very deep. And Michael knows, Geraldo Rivera's neighbor.
Oh, well, like almost as good.
And it was somehow they got back and forth. He goes, well, Geraldo Rivera is my neighbor.
Orville
and
Schell. This is incredible, this list. James Fallows. Incredible. I, Justine, Robert Lustig. Holy cow. I mean, just an amazing list of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing, again, it's just an incredible. And once what happens now is that you have all these. Anyway, so we're going to.
Graymatter.show. And, of course, if you want to check out Office Hours and Ian's interview on Monday, officehours.global. It's a Zoom call you can join or watch on YouTube after the fact. Thank you, Alex Lindsay. I did not mention the entire show that Alex, he has a day job. and you can get him to, you know, help you set up your next event at
really
090.media. He works there.
I mostly work on really, really complex live events.
Complex live events are him. 090.media. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. Still going to be at 1800 for the next couple of weeks, but we will be moving to daylight, or rather standard time. In a little bit, right after Halloween. I think it's the first Sunday after Halloween so that the candy makers can get all of the candy in your children that's possible. And then we'll fall back. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Right now it's 1800 UTC. You can watch or listen to the live stream at live.twit.tv. Or you can also get on-demand versions of the show. You can go to the website for it, twit.tv/MBW. You can also watch the YouTube channel that's got Mac Break Weekly. It's dedicated. And of course, the best way to do this would be subscribe in the podcast to the audio or video versions in your favorite podcast player. And that way you'll have it automatically whenever it's available. Should mention that members of Club Twit get ad-free versions of this show and all of our shows, plus special programming we don't put out anywhere, including that interview with John Scalzi, Aunt Pruitt did earlier last week. All you got to do is go to twit.tv/clubtwit, fork over $7 a month, and all this could be yours. Plus, and there's no price on this, the wonderful, warm, happy feeling you'd have in your heart knowing you're keeping Twit running, and that is very important to me, too. So thank you in advance. Twit.tv/club twit. That does it for this week's Mac Break Weekly. It is my sad duty to tell you at this point, you must go back to work because break time is over. Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.